What am I doing? Oh, I see you do. Very cool. I came up to get my script.
I have my script. Oh, sorry. I was talking. I had myself muted. I'm so sorry. Now you can hear me. Hi, Norman.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm good.
I was just talking away, and I was...
Well, you know, that's better than silence.
Silence for our office.
You couldn't hear me before? Okay. Well, let me just stay off of my headphones, and I'll just put on speaker. Can you hear me now?
I hear you. I hear you fine. Hi. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. Oh, I thought you couldn't hear me again.
it was going in and out, yes.
Oh, okay. All right. So anyway, I just wanted to say, you know, that you are the founder of Oakland Public Theater, and you are joining us to talk about the James Baldwin Centennial Project, which has debuted already August 1st through 4th. It's at the Carroll Hill Neighborhood House in San Francisco, and it's in collaboration with Playground.
Oh, no, not the
and...
Neighborhood House. This is the Potrero Stage, not the Neighborhood House.
Potrero. Okay, thank you. Different place. Potrero Stage. I knew that. I just wrote it wrong. and it's having its debut this weekend, and tonight is one of those days.
Tonight is our official opening. Last night was
cool,
a preview.
Cool. All right, and also it's going to be coming over to the East Bay to BAM House. What is it coming over to Oakland?
We will we'll preview in Oakland on the 22nd. And then start our run on the 23rd, and we'll go through September 1st, Sunday matinees, Thursday through Friday, 8 o'clock.
Cool. So tell us about, you know, this project and what drew you to it. And I'm so excited you are drawn to it, and I didn't get through the whole script, but it looks really amazing, all these wonderful characters, you know, that, you know, our ancestors now, like Lorraine Hansberry and, gosh, you know, all those civil rights leaders that are speaking. And it just sounds like it's going to be really amazing because you mentioned that, you know, you're being alum of Word for Word, that, you know, you don't change anything. You just let the words have their own energy, and you have these different voices, you know, through various actors telling this story of this man in his own words. So tell us about the project and also the other key players in the writing and in the performance.
Sure. Well, this was inspired by, you may remember, Oakland Public Theater years ago did a Richard Wright Centennial Project. And, you know, that African-American author, the local playwright, Richard Talavera, came to me with this idea to do the Richard Wright Centennial Project. And I said I didn't know much about Richard Wright, and he told me a few things that really piqued my interest. And I said, okay, let's do it. And he said, oh, and I don't want to write a single word. And I said, what? And he said, well, you know, among the other amazing facts, Richard Wright moved to Paris at the height of his popularity in America. He wrote Native Son, and that did really well. And then he put out a semi-autobiographical book, Black Boy, and that did really well. And at the same time, he felt like a segregated America wasn't going to be comfortable for him, his white wife, and their mixed child. So he moved to Paris, and Paris greeted him with open arms. Well, America was fascinated, you know, their eyes were opened, I guess woke might be the right term, by this man who talked about the black experience in a new way. The black community was definitely inspired by him, so a bunch of people followed him to Paris. So you have other writers like Chester Himes, who's mostly known for these detective novels. There's Ollie Harrington, who was a political cartoonist in the Negro Press, and a very young James Baldwin, who all decided that they too were tired of America and ready for something new. So they all wrote about their experiences there together. And so we drew from each of those voices and some biographers and some articles and interviews, and we created this kind of mosaic of who Richard Wright was. So knowing about James Baldwin through that process, I knew the centennial was coming up. And, you know, like many of us, when we had the COVID lockdown, we didn't know what we were going to do. And I was fortunate to get an artist grant. And I said, well, why don't we start doing research for this project? So we started reading stuff. So Richard Talavera has been involved with it from the beginning. I've got a whole slew of folks that were reading, and then we did a series of staged readings of different pieces. We did a piece about people don't know that James Baldwin loved poetry and wrote poetry. So we did a piece about his poetry. We did a piece about Giovanni's Room, and how that impacted the world, his second novel, where he did two things that people weren't expecting. One, he wrote a novel that was largely about white people, and it was about homosexuals. So people weren't ready for that. And so we had a little bit of people talking about the book, as well as a little bit of the book. So we got all these different pieces together. And so right now I'm working with, can I name everybody? Jake Fong, Giselle Garcia, who was just in Biggie and Tupac at the BAM House. Reg Clay, who was my Richard Wright in the original production, and we have one scene with Richard Wright in this where he's doing that as well as playing other roles. He plays a father. Elena Ruggiero, I always have trouble pronouncing her name correctly, but she has joined us to fill out the cast. And a man I had not been aware of before, this Preston Stone, who has come in, and he ends up playing the white guy in a lot of these roles. But that includes RFK, not the guy running for president, but the original RFK, when he was brother to the president, you know, John Kennedy. We have a piece mm-hmm. with him meeting with civil rights leaders. You know, these are things people might not be aware of. So I wanted to make sure that we were giving, you know, things that people might say, oh, yeah, I know that about James Baldwin. I'd love to see more about that. But we also wanted to give them stuff that they might not be familiar with. And the big piece that helped pull it all together was there's a book called Baldwin's Turkish Decade, because this Polish professor got fascinated, as a student, she got fascinated with the fact that Baldwin had spent a decade in Istanbul, and nobody talks about it. And this is at the height of his, you know, this is as 1961, where he's starting to become a major figure. He starts reporting on the civil rights movement at that time and writes his second novel and is working on his third novel but having trouble. And he lands in Istanbul, gets the novel done, and has a few other experiences as he travels back and forth between Paris, United States, visiting family, visiting publishers, trying to get a screenplay up. So, you know, he goes on this sort of whirlwind decade of travel and eventually decides that he's ready to settle down, and he goes back to the south of France and spends the rest of his life there. So we try to cover just that period before. With Richard Wright, we covered the last few years of his life. With Baldwin, we ended up covering this period because I think people don't know anything about it.
Right.
Oh,
yeah,
and
I missed
mm-hmm. one young actor, Christian Jimenez, who was in the lead last year in the Word for Word show Citizen. And mm-hmm. he was a last-minute replacement in that show. He was fabulous. And I walked up to him afterwards to say, wow, that was incredible work. And he said, don't you recognize me, Norman? And it turns out that he was one of my high school students just a few years ago.
Oh, my goodness.
I think it's the first time I've ever seen that.
Wow. Oh, that is amazing. That is amazing. Wow. And I just want to mention, I just pulled up the the Mechanics Institute program.
And that's tonight, yes.
In his own words, a James Baldwin Centennial Celebration, and it's co-sponsored by the Museum of the African Diaspora. It starts at 6:30, and you are going to be there as well.
Right, I'm the first featured speaker, and then I have to run out the door and get across town for the show.
Right, yeah. And so I just want to read a little bit of your bio from that program. Do you happen
sure.
to know the Mechanics Institute address? Because I can't leave this page where I'm on right at the moment.
I don't, but I can find it while you read my bio.
Okay, cool. So Norman Yee has worked with companies including SF Shakes, Word for Word, Lorraine Hansberry, which is so cool calling her name, and she's in the play too because she was a good friend of James Baldwin's. Theater Works, Shogun Players, Central Works Perspective Theater, and Open Theater Project, of course. He recently performed in Great Expectations with San Jose Stage Company. Last summer, he understudied and performed in Pericles for San Francisco Shakes. He's the founder of Oakland Public Theater, which we already mentioned. Norman creates a different kind of black theater, expanding notions of culture to encompass often invisible roles of African Americans. He also embraces a new position as Playground Associate Producer. Oh, I didn't know you were in-house too. Wow. Playground is a wonderful organization, you know, fostering new play development.
I am a director and actor and associate producer, yes.
Oh, all those things. Wonderful. Because I've seen you in Playground Presents program.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And then also I wanted to mention, you see, the Baldwin Project is a follow-up to the similar project you already mentioned with playwright Richard Talavera, Before the Dream, and the mysterious death and life of Richard Wright. And I don't know if you remember, but you were also a part of the African-American Celebration Through Poetry, where you performed or gave us some of this play. And in that particular time, Julia Wright, Richard Wright's daughter from Paris, shared some of his haikus through the phone and microphone at the library, at the West Oakland Library at that time.
Oh.
So anyway, yeah, yeah. So that was exciting.
Yeah,
as
the
well
haikus.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Oh, and I also wanted to mention that Pam Africa, who was with the Family and Friends with Mia Abu-Jamal, she shared Julia Wright's, he introduced her and shared Julia Wright's activism around freeing Mumia Abu-Jamal, who was still in prison and who was 70 years old this year as
wow.
April. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He has a new book out. Go ahead.
Very
and say
cool.
What you were going to say about the haiku.
Oh, I was just, yeah, that was one of the amazing things that Richard told me, that this African-American author at the end of his life became fascinated with that form, the Japanese poetry form, the haiku, and he started writing. Mm-hmm. He wrote over 400. They're published in a book, and they are so beautiful. But they're also kind of autobiographical. So in that piece, we actually used a bunch of the haikus sort of as a, you know, as a continuing theme between scenes, but also very much reflecting on all the different things we were seeing. In this play, Baldwin writes this large poem called Inventory / On Being 52. And it's a large poem. I found it fascinating that he was meditating on this idea of, it's a recurring theme in the poem, of his journey to the Palace of Wisdom, that he is trying to attain something. He's trying to get somewhere, and he's he feels like he's having trouble. Other personal, he's got other things that are getting in the way that are distracting him. His successes are, he recognizes them, acknowledges them, and celebrates them, but they're not enough. Somehow he wants more. So I thought it was a really cool piece to use as a framing device. So our two framing devices are him traveling between Paris and Istanbul, and this poem, which also represents a different journey, a journey of the mind, of the spirit, and of the creative force, that he's hoping to find something, what's that next big thing, I guess, would be a way to put it. But to me, what's wonderfully ironic about it is, this is a man who has already achieved so much by this point in his life, and he's actually going to die 11 years after this. But he never stopped wanting to, find a way to keep finding his voice and staying relevant to the issues of the time. And it's wonderful now, because you see all these Baldwin quotes everywhere that seem to speak to what we're doing, what we're dealing with in our current political struggles. And he was talking about that 60 years ago.
Yeah, so true, so true. And I wanted to come back to the McCammon's Institute program.
Yep, I got that address. It's 57 Post Street. 57 Post Street. San Francisco.
Cool. And again, the program starts at 6:30. It's not going to be a long program. Then, Jill Gomez, remember when she did Giovanni's Ring? And she made it into a play, and it was just the African American the art and culture complex. That was so lovely.
Yeah, I was James Baldwin.
No!
I was the James Baldwin when that was done. Yes.
I didn't remember the actors. I just remember she wrote it and I was there. Oh, okay. That's, what do you call that, a foreshadowing?
When it was just a reading, and then they actually got to develop a full production at the New Conservatory Theater.
Right. Yeah. I think I saw it in both places, but I totally remember the reading. Because it was so new. And I don't think a whole lot of plays have been written about James Baldwin.
There's a what, you said?
I said, I don't know of a lot of plays written about James Baldwin. Are there?
No, I don't either. I do know. So Rich Clay played my Richard Wright when we did the Richard Wright piece. He was so inspired by it, he wrote a play called Four Men in Paris about those same characters, Richard Wright, Ollie Harrington, Chester Himes, and James Baldwin. And, yeah, I hadn't seen many other people doing it. It was such a fascinating story. The idea that at a time when in America there was such a heavy level of racial oppression going on, and these men suddenly felt free. This is after World War II, and they are just enjoying Paris and, free to live their lives. One of the other characters that pops up in this play is Chester Himes. And he traveled, for the rest of his life, he traveled Europe. He's a very fascinating character, and it's so the opposite of what was going on in America. So it just felt like it was great for us to sort of reclaim that history and the joy of it.
Yeah.
These are men who are really, they're artists. They have decided not just to get out from oppression, but they found ways to express themselves artistically and talk about not just their plight, but the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. I'm going to read the bio that's in the program for the McCammon's Institute. I think it's short and sweet. James Baldwin, born August 2nd, 1924, New York, the United States, died December 1st, 1987. in St. Paul de Vinche, France. He was an essayist, a novelist, and playwright whose eloquence and passion on the subject of race in America made him one of the most important voices of the 20th century. A writer of exceptionally clear and psychologically penetrating prose, Baldwin addressed race relations with depth, complexity, and incisive anger. He was also one of the first Black writers to include fear scenes in fiction, notably in Giovanni Jones in 1956, writing with a frankness that was highly controversial. His works include the novels Go Tell It on the Mountain, 1953, and Another Country in 1952. The plays The Amen Corner, 1954, and Blues for Mr. Charlie, 1964, and the essay collection Nobody Knows My Name, 1961, and The Fire Next Time. And I wanted to mention that one of my favorite collections of his, because he is a phenomenal essayist, is Notes of a Native Son. I just love that.
Yes.
And really
title
essay. Yeah, I used to teach Baldwin in my freshman comp, but not the freshman comp that's transferable, but the class before that. And my students were like, oh my God, this is so difficult. But I'm like, you know, you wanna know how to write well, you gotta read writers that write well. And this man is, I mean, there are other great essayists, but he is amazing. I mean, he could just write across genres. And that particular book, Notes of a Native Son, I really love. And then my other favorite book is Fire Next Time. There's two essays, you know, particularly the one, you know, to his brother. I just love that relationship, you know, between the two siblings and the way he tells us how, you know, he'd have a baby on the one arm and he'd have a pin on the other. And you can really sort of imagine that, because he just loved to write. And he wrote the school song for his elementary school. I mean, who does that?
A piece that we pull in as well. His teacher in, I think it was middle school, was County Cullen, who had been the premier poet of the Harlem Renaissance. You know, people don't remember him as well because there was sort of a second wave of the Harlem Renaissance, and that's when people like Langston Hughes rose up. But County Cullen had been that first one, and he was Baldwin's teacher. He taught Baldwin about poetry, and he had Baldwin become the editor of the school newspaper.
Wow, that's amazing. And I don't know if people know that Baldwin was, you know, involved. I think he was. Wasn't he involved in the civil rights movement? Because I know he got so angry, that's why he went abroad.
Well, a recurring theme that we have is riffing off of the documentary that came out a few years ago, I'm Not Your Negro. So we have things like, I'm not your Negro poet. I'm not your Negro activist. I'm not your holy roller. Because Baldwin, throughout his life, would just refuse labels. So he would say he was not an activist, but that he was a witness. He felt like all American citizens should be paying attention to what was going on. And as a member of the Black community, he could testify to the atrocities and the oppression that were daily. But he kept avoiding the label of activist. And it's, you know, there was so much material, things that we couldn't get in. One of the pieces I really wished we could have gotten in is, people don't know that the 1963 March on Washington, where Martin Luther King did his I Have a Dream speech, Baldwin was originally slated to be a speaker at the protest, at the march. And he flew in, and then they told him, we took you off the bill. You know, if they're taking Bayard Rustin, who actually helped put the whole thing together, off the bill because, you know, he's a gay man and he's a communist, they definitely weren't going to take this much more out and vocal Black gay man and put him up. So these are the moments where Baldwin, is he an activist or is he not? He's definitely a fellow traveler, and he definitely speaks for us all, but he refused the label of activist.
Yeah. And I want to mention that Raul Peck is the director of I'm Not Your Negro, Samuel L. Jackson, which came out in February 2017, and it's available. Yeah, I did notice that with the script that's a refrain. Yeah.
Well, and it's the Roxy had these short films featuring James Baldwin that were wonderful. And it's everybody, you know, people around here may know The Price of a Ticket, which was done by a very early KQED documentary. Mm-hmm. James Baldwin visiting the city and talking to black people about their experiences, something he loved to do throughout his life. He always loved talking to young people. But the Roxy featured a bunch of shorts about him, and we actually touch on one of them in the play. Sadat Pake, P-A-K-A, was a Turkish man who, as a young man, I think he said he was in high school when he first saw a picture of James Baldwin, and he went on to make this beautiful little film. You can see clips of it online. It's very personal. It's very intimate, and it's just James Baldwin being James Baldwin, but I felt like it also captured his place in the world. They do sections of the film where he is wandering around town and he's wandering through plazas, and you see all these men, and you know it's not America, and you know it's not even Europe, really. It's someplace else, and they are fascinated with him, and he is fascinated with them, and the camera completely captures this. We showed it at one of our rehearsals. We showed a two-minute clip at one of our rehearsals. And at the very end, it caught one of those plaza moments, and everybody was like, what is that? Because there's just a way where the camera captures him in contrast to everyone else around him. I feel like there's not a better image of James Baldwin than that. He was always his own man. He always found a way. He loved being around people. He loved interacting with people, but he was always his own person.
Yeah. James Baldwin, when he was here in San Francisco, Baby Hunter's Point, it was right after the young person being shot by the police in Baby Hunter's Point. Residents were in uproar. It was in 1963. And I think the documentary is called Take This Hammer. It was produced by KQED. And then, I'm not sure which anniversary it was. I don't know if it was 20 years later, 10 years, it was like 20 years later. A filmmaker who lived here looked back at that time, 50 years later, and looked at who these young people were that met James Baldwin, because he had known that what was going on in the North, in the cities, in the West.
Right.
You know, people knew about what was happening in the South, but they didn't know what was happening else. It's similar to Martin Luther King, you know, when he went and stayed in Chicago in the tenement, you know, with the poor people. Like, oh.
Right.
And I think, was that when the Poor People's Movement was kicked off? Is that when that happened?
I wouldn't be surprised. These are histories that I find myself, I constantly keep learning new things about. For example, one of our minor characters in the show is Clarence Jones, an advisor to Martin Luther King. Well, he's still alive.
Yes, I know. He works there.
And
he
so it's fascinating to know this isn't history. This is living history.
Yeah. I was really, really pleased to see Clarence Jones, Dr. Jones, because I didn't know he was there in the room at that time. I was like, oh, my goodness, he's everywhere. Because, you know, he smuggled out that speech. Letters from the Birmingham. He was Martin T. Jr.'s attorney, and he gave him that on paper, not paper, but tissue, took it out, and that's how come we know it.
That's amazing. Yeah, no, it's wild when we do this work, because I don't want to, I want to respect the people, the source material, but at the same time, I want to make it clear to the audience that that's what we're doing. We're lifting up, we're reflecting this material. You know, this is not, I didn't, like in terms of our actors, Jake Fong is playing James Baldwin. And James Jake is not a small man. James Baldwin was a small man. And I was like, well, but there's also an everyman quality to him. There's a way where he speaks for us. And so in that sense, I toyed with the idea. In fact, Giselle Garcia, young actor who I saw in this show at the BAM House with the Lower Bottom Players, Biggie and Tupac are dead, and she was just so amazing. So I was like, oh, I want to have her in the show. Well, when she came in to read, she started saying, well, I like playing multiple roles, but you could also cast me. I'm okay with being cast as a man. And I had her read some of the James Baldwin stuff, and just for a moment I thought, oh, maybe I'm going to go there. We did find a way around it by, as we use one of a section of Go Tell It on the Mountain, which is fictional, but very clearly a young James Baldwin featured in that piece. We were able to work around this. But, I feel like there's a way where he does speak for us all. So I hope that the audience comes away wanting to know more about some of the things that we show them and feeling like there's an ownership that we all get to have with this.
Well, let me invite our other guest, into the studio. Good morning from Miami. How are you? Jenny Zulu? He doesn't know. Okay, so I'm going to text him. So in the meantime.
Yeah, that's what we can do now, yes. Texting is great.
Right. So I don't know how much time you have, because today is your opening, and you are also double billed. But I wanted to ask you, do you want to share anything from the play with us?
Well, one of the discoveries was the County Cullen, and I could share his poem is fairly short, and it's probably the poem he's most famous for. It's called "And Yet Do I Marvel," and he says, "I doubt not God is good, well-meaning, kind. And did he stoop to quibble, could tell why the little berry mole continues blind. Why flesh that mirrors his must someday die. Make plain the reason tortured Tantalus is baited by the fickle fruit. Declare, if merely brute caprice dooms Sisyphus to struggle up a never-ending stair. Inscrutable his ways are, and immune to catechism by a mind too strewn with petty cares to slightly understand what awful brain compels his awful hand. Yet do I marvel at this curious thing, to make a poet black and bid him sing."
I remember that.
Yeah, it's funny. I grew up with Langston Hughes, so when I started reading the County Cullen, and I have an old like baseball trading card. I have an old African American Figures trading card set from when I was a young man, and County Cullen was one of the pictures in there, and I was like, "Who is he?" But this show gave me a chance to learn a lot more about him.
Yeah. Wow, I'm happy that if you all were able to do this work. Like I said, James Baldwin. I remember one time I rented a vehicle and it was called Jimmy. It just felt like I was riding. And because he just seemed so, just so present with you and so kind. Didn't you feel like if you didn't know him, you thought, "Can I give you a hug?" And you thought, "Yeah." It just seemed like
I was happy that I was happy he got to spend the end of his life, because in the south of France, he had basically this little chateau, and he he hosted everybody, Nina Simone, Miles Davis, what's his name, Buford Delaney, I think is the painter. You know, there were writers, painters. Don Cherry came through when he was in Istanbul, and he was directing. He got an opportunity to direct a play that was very hot at the time, Fortune in Men's Eyes. We have a taste of that in the show. And he asked Don Cherry if he would write a score for him. So there's a whole album, tried to get it, and it's not coming out until September. There's a release of this. They found it, and they're reissuing it, but they said it's not coming out until September. But I was amazed that he got to spend the last like 15 or more years of his life in the south of France, hosting folks, doing what he liked to do. In Istanbul, his habit became that he would write all night, go to sleep, wake up in the morning, and he would come down for coffee and breakfast and read the pages. And one of his friends, I can't remember the guy's name right now, but he ended up becoming his assistant for many years. The day he met him, he walked in and Baldwin said, "I finished the book." And he read to people the last part of Another Country. And that was how he met James Baldwin. I'm like, to imagine being around somebody in that in creative environment. You know, at that point, he really had distanced himself from America. He felt like things weren't changing or weren't changing fast enough. To be told by somebody, the debate where he debates with William F. Buckley, and Buckley says he could imagine a Negro 40 years from now becoming president, you know, to which Baldwin later said, "How long are we supposed to wait? You know, my parents, my mother waited, my father waited, my niece and my nephew have waited. How long must we wait for your progress?"
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was just thinking about what you said, his mother and father. And, you know, his father, I think his father was, because it was his stepfather.
Stepfather, yes.
Yeah, stepfather. Hadn't his stepfather's parents been enslaved? Because his stepfather was really brutal to him. But a lot of people coming out of enslaved were brutal.
Well, it's wild to me. I feel like he's fairly respectful when he writes about his father. He says there was a distance. He says there was a coldness. And he says the man was hard on them. And he has, like, we actually have... We finished with a Nikki Giovanni interview, which was on this beautiful program. You know, again, this was the early days of public television. So on the New York station, they hosted a program called Soul. And at one point, the host, Ellis Hazlett, decided he wanted to interview James Baldwin. He had started Soul, like a first or second episode, had a very young Cassius Clay, who had just changed his name to Muhammad Ali, come on to the show and talk about that. So the show, you know, had music, poetry, but it also had the figures of the day, and he wanted James Baldwin, and Baldwin refused to come back to the United States. So he made arrangements and sent a crew to London to film it, and he asked a very young Nikki Giovanni. So Nikki Giovanni at that point was 28, and Baldwin was about 20 years older than her, and she went and she interviewed him. And so we kind of finish with that. And again, there's a way where he just always loved talking to young people. Mm-hmm. It's just amazing that you can find these things. They're available. You just have to go search for them.
Right. And it's so interesting that you mentioned this show and that particular program being interviewed by Nikki Giovanni. And actually, I have that. I
it's 2 hours. It's amazing.
Yeah. I have 56. But it is amazing. It is available. All of the different episodes that you get.
Yeah, we couldn't squeeze everything in. We squeezed in as much as we could. And we still managed to get in, even including intermission, we still managed to get in under 2 hours. So I'm very happy about that. The show is pulling together. This weekend is really kind of a sneak peek. We are we have just pulled all of our elements together, but I didn't want to miss the birthday. So I'm like, oh, no, we'll do the birthday weekend, and then we'll, you know, we'll fine-tune it for Oakland.
Yes, certainly. Just think about the talk about, you know, being a public person, and being a public person. You know, everybody's watching you, so you just can't do it. You have to, like, hold that awareness and animation. You need to hold that in a way that you do things that are respectful, because you know folks are going to be emulating. He's emulating me, and I just think about James Bond, his public system. You know, there was an integrity to how he moved and what he did and what he did. So I can think about, you know, I was ready, who knows if he would even have to live a life with everything. It is one of
I'm sorry, tell you. The dates and stuff?
No, no, no.
I'm sorry, I can't understand you.
Sorry.
Potrero Stage address? Yeah, I just
Oh, Potrero Stage address is, I believe it's 1895. Let me make sure I've got that correct. But it's 18th Street. It's DeHaro is the nearest intersection.
Yeah, it's down the hill.
San Francisco, so it's in the Potrero neighborhood.
And you can definitely do it on public transportation. It just takes a minute. I've done it before.
Yeah, it's the 22. If you go, BART, to 16th Street Station and take the 22, it'll take you to 17th Street. So you're one block away, and you just walk over that block. Yeah, that's...
Okay, cool. Yeah, and then also, which I thought was really great, is that the right address, the one you told us?
I'm looking right now. Performance Space, Potrero Stage 16, 1695 18th Street, San Francisco.
Okay, cool.
And then, the BAM House will be downtown Oakland, Broadway, in the corner of 15th. It's one block away from BART. It's very, very convenient.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And I wanted to mention that for the Potrero Stage performances, and I don't know about BAM House, people can see the play virtually, which I think is really wonderful.
Yes. Potrero Stage is set up for broadcasting, so we will be tonight, tomorrow, and Sunday afternoon we'll be broadcasting. At BAM House, we are just going to broadcast the last show. So it'll be September 1st, the 2 o'clock Sunday matinee on September 1st we will broadcast. But, yeah, people don't, you know, I've been sending out information across the country. I'm like, please, you know, check us out.
Right. Cool. Super. Well, thank you so much, Norma, for joining us, and I look forward to seeing you in person, but definitely online. I'm going to be one of those folks tuning in via the broadcast.
Yeah, the live stream.
The live stream, yes. So people.
Well, and the other nice thing about the live stream is once you get your ticket, you can actually view it you have about a week. They keep it up for about a week, so.
Okay, that's good to
know.
Yeah,
that'll be fun.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so get your ticket.
Baldwin Centennial Project, all one word, baldwincentennialproject.com.
All right, cool, super. And I link to that in the description of the program. All righty, coolness.
Great, thank you.
Yes, let me see if, Jimmy Zulu, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, super.
Can you hear
me?
Do
you want to say anything to Norman? Yeah, we can hear you.
Well, I am so glad. I thank you so much for, first of all, awakening me to the fact that today was the bicentennial of James Arthur birth, Baldwin's birth. And it was just fascinating listening to what Norman had to share. I'll just throw in, you know, I did get to meet him, you know, on one occasion, and it was memorable. And
wow.
Yeah, he was really, you know, I hardly need to say, just one of the most special people that this country or the human race ever produced, you know. I think so. It we'd be remiss if we didn't mention, you know, we mentioned his essays, we mentioned his poetry, which a lot of people didn't know about, but his short story, Sonny's Blues, that another late great departed genius, Tom Feelings, the, you know, the visual artist, I had invited him to speak when I was teaching college English at our local, you know, Miami-Dade Community College, and my students were there and others. And he wasn't even aware, Tom wasn't even aware that just like a couple of weeks before I had taught Sonny's Blues, and he was saying to the group, and you know, he came to really talk about his art, but he opened up with, he just had to share that, look, if you don't ever read any other short story in your life, you have to read James Baldwin's Sonny's Blues. and he was kind of making the point that not only it was like this quintessential example of writing craft, but it was such a, you know, multi-layered, multifaceted, true depiction of, you know, America, American society, and you know, just briefly for, you know, those who might not be, you know, altogether familiar, you know, he has his first person protagonist who's an algebra teacher in a high school in Harlem, and his brother, Sonny, his younger brother, you know, and he, as you know, he grew up as the father figure with his, you know, younger brothers in real life, you know, gets strung out on heroin, and he's this kind of straight out old guy who just can't believe how you could be wasting your life, but Sonny is awakening him to this whole world of this creative music with Charlie Parker and, you know, the whole bebop movement and all that. And so it becomes a metaphor for, you know, so many things, you know, at the same time. And, you know, the way Sonny, I mean, his ear for music, I mean, even as a kind of street corner church group singing gospel, and Sonny just tunes into that and the beauty of the woman's voice. And and so here's like this, you know, everyday scene in Harlem, but the story just elevates to like, you know, if you pause and really listen, I mean, you're walking among, you know, you're walking in the diamond mine of you know, wisdom, culture, beauty, and so forth. So, I've been sort of, not nearly as thoroughly as you've done, Norman, but kind of finding and collecting, you know, like some of the speeches, you know, the debate with William referred to. And then there's a, he gave a speech, it's called A Talk to Teachers, that was published in Saturday Review. It was a speech he gave in Berkeley. And just talking to teachers about, like, the reality of what, you know, black, you know, students are going through. And I think one of the most memorable lines, going back to Sonny's Blues, he's talking about these kids in Harlem, it's a boys' high school, And he has this great line with, these boys are growing up in a rush, and their heads were already bumping against the low ceiling of possibilities that were going to be open to them. In the hallways, and, you know, they leave the school, and all the laughter, but the laughter is not help, it's derisive, it's putting down other people. It's just, you know, like how this, like when you stifle people's possibilities, you create this whole corrosive environment where people cannot, you know, this is his whole central, you know, where people aren't even invited to fully appreciate who they are, their self-worth, and so forth. And he makes it very clear, you know, in so many of his, writings and teachings, how this extends absolutely automatically to white America. I mean, you deprive other people, you deprive yourself. I mean, his wisdom was really one of the great, great legacies, and I really so much appreciate, both of you, bringing this whole, today's centennial of his birth to my attention. I'll certainly, share around with, my folks, just, remind us that, let's pause and remember who this brother was, especially these days. I mean, because you have, when we think, Martin Luther King was assassinated in 1968, that's more than 50 years ago. Three-quarters of the population is 50 or under.
Right.
So this is like ancient history. You have folks who are grandparents now who have, like, they feel no connection to, it's kind of like, like my generation hearing about Marcus Garvey, like, wow, that must have been something, But, we go back to, you just think of, we sometimes can mythologize and romanticize what traditional African villages were like. But the fact that there was this whole responsibility that every generation had to educate the next generation, from the time your children, know who you are, know where you come from, when a newborn child is born, everybody, who is this child? Why has this child come among us? That you everybody observes and tries to cultivate. But what is that individual's talents, interests that we can, help grow? And, I get the feeling reading, Baldwin, that he was just so keenly aware of that kind of thing. I mean, the fact that, personhood and self-development is really the, there's a whole theological thing about that, personalism that I think, Dr. Martin Luther King himself was kind of steeped in that, in his, very formal academic training, that, good, bad, all of these decisions, really comes down to, well, who is the person that you are? I think that's such a powerful theme in James Baldwin's, his presence and his contributions, if you will. And of course, I have another level of empathy with him because I did have a chance to live in Europe, in France, for a couple of years, and got to see some of the people he saw, and fully experience that sense of just escape. And oh my God, you can breathe here, you talk to people, and you have a conversation between human beings. You're not talking like you're talking to the like the visitor in prison, where you got to talk through this filter of, well, you're one of them, and I'm
right. It's something that I wonder if our younger generation can fully appreciate. But the fact is, those generations before us achieved things, it's hard to remember what they lived under.
Right.
So with Richard Wright, you get that he's married to a white woman, has a mixed child, and he can't, even in New York, there are hotels and restaurants that they can't go in together.
Right.
With Baldwin, it's that moment where he's out with a friend and they're at a cafe and this woman refuses to serve him. And he, as he describes it, throws a glass and shatters the mirror behind the bar, behind the counter, and takes off because, you know, it's like, you are about to get in trouble. And that was when he said, oh, I have to leave this country to recognize what it takes for you to get to that place in your life to be that angry, that frustrated, mm-hmm. that I'm not going to take it anymore.
Right.
And yet still explain it in a way that makes you feel, that makes us, the reader, feel like you, even under that, you still felt like you didn't have a right to do it. You felt like you were wrong for just standing up for yourself.
Right. Wow. How profound is that, you know? Yeah, yeah. And that really goes, I think, to the core of so many of us, and that's why it's so important to have that kind of encouragement to be, you know, introspective and we had a friend, one of the famed New Orleans Mardi Gras Indians costume makers, and he was talking about going around to. He was invited to speak at schools all around the state of Louisiana. And, you know, this whole thing about slavery would come up, and he would have to say, look, don't you ever be ashamed of the fact that your ancestors were enslaved. The people who did the enslaving are the ones who are supposed to feel ashamed, you know?
Right,
but
right.
As logical as that is, I mean, just the objective conditions that we live in, it just... You know, how do you, like a kid who's, you know, not doing well in school, how do you really encourage this kid where it's kind of, well, you know, what good would it do, you know? So, you know, and I don't think many people have you know, exposed that. You know, to the in the same way that people like James Baldwin and Malcolm X and so forth, where you really bring out this thing like up front, close and personal, you know. And of course, it's, you know, it's challenging. I mean, you know, when Malcolm X talks about, you know, black men, can you stand up? You know, are you willing to stand up to a white man to protect your woman? And you know, and then like. You know, these things were, now we're going all the way back to things that got put in place aboard slave ships and all the rest. And,
right.
You know, like, who wants to go there, but, well, do we have the right not to go there, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, it's, you're reminding me of the Nikki Giovanni Baldwin discussion, their conversation, because they definitely... You know, how can you blame this man for how he's reacting to the way the world is treating him? And they chew that up pretty well.
Uh-huh. Right. Yeah, I've known of that. I've never actually seen or heard it. So now you've inspired me to go get that, and I'm sure it's going to be rewarding. Yeah.
Oh yeah, it's fascinating. The discussions of it talk about how, and she did in "I'm Not Your Negro." She present day talks about what that experience was. One of the things she points to is in America, if they had filmed it, the cameras would have been stuck on their faces. But in London, for some reason, they were fascinated with their gestures. So we had to debate whether or not we were going to have cigarettes in the show because they are both smoking like crazy the whole time. And you could see how somebody finishes that cigarette, stubs it out to light up another one so they can make their next point.
Right.
No,
right,
if you grew up in that era, you recognize that. You're like, oh, yeah, I remember that. My grandma was doing that all the time.
Right, and you made me think of what was it, Young, Gifted, and Black, that beautiful documentary that was done on Lorraine Hansberry, and I mean, and same thing. I mean, the lighters and the smoke and the cigarettes. Well, the cigarette was. Yeah. I mean, I think if there's any one iconic item of the 20th century, it would be the cigarette. It came in at the beginning of the century and faded out of the end, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it became so central to just, you know, how people socialized.
Yes.
Yeah, but also I want to interrupt, because I think that the reason why the cigarette is sort of associated with, taking a break is because when you smoke a cigarette, you are meditating, and so you're breathing. So that's how, I mean, at the height of this structural racism, how do you meditate? How do you take a break? How do you pause?
Mm.
And you breathe. And so people are breathing smoke, but they're breathing.
Right.
They are relaxing. Because, the coffee and the cigarette, that's how you relax. It's not healthy, but now
right.
we know better.
Right.
And we meditate.
Right. Yeah, you relax the stimulants. I mean, how about that, huh?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you take stimulants so you can calm down.
Well,
that's such a key point, and I've been in Winston-Salem in North Carolina, where Reynolds Tobacco, I mean, built the town was built around, if you could almost say, and they were people that used to work, like, if they had meetings, they'd have bowls of cigarettes on the tables, and that they just encouraged you to just and then it was supposed to be this whole sign of sophistication and maturity and all that went with it,
So I want to play this Nikki Giovanni interviewing James Baldwin. I haven't listened to it in a while, but it is kind of long, and I want people to be able to get through it. So again, we're speaking to Norman Gee about this wonderful Norman Gee. Sorry. thanks so much for the correction. About this wonderful production that went up yesterday, and the opening is tonight, about James Baldwin Centennial Project, and the title of it is, what's the title of the work?
Inventory / James Baldwin Abroad.
Okay, inventory, James Brown. Yeah, I see that. Okay, and it's up again at the Potrero Stage in San Francisco through the 4th, which is Sunday, and it is live streaming each day. And then the play moves to Oakland, where it's going to be at BAM House August 22nd through September 1st, and BAM House is in downtown Oakland. And so... and then the last performance in Oakland is also going to be live streamed. That's September 1st, the matinee. And so donations are accepted for the Oakland performance. However, don't let money keep you from seeing it live or watching it live streamed.
Yes, we're doing a new sort of a ticketing thing where you can kind of pick your price. When you go to the ticket page, it has a suggested price. You can hit the drop down menu, and you can scroll up or down as much as you want.
Yeah, that's innovative.
Yeah, that's very nice.
Can I just squeeze in one more thing, please?
Let me mention the website one more time.
Sure.
It's BaldwinCentennialProject.com, BaldwinCentennialProject.com, and you'll find out where you can get tickets for either one of the productions and all the information about the performance
and its creation.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, you know, there's another side of Baldwin's life experience. You know, the fact mm-hmm. that in high school, he went to high school at the same school, same time with Richard Avedon, the
yes.
photographer,
oh,
and
yes. oh.
Emil Capulla, the literary editor of the Nation magazine, and they knew each other, and it makes me think of Paul Laurence Dunbar, you know, being in the same high school, same time with the Wright brothers in Dayton, Ohio, like, mm. and that they were friends, and you know, who was to say what that chemistry kind of created for the people who were part of it, you know? And mm-hmm. I thought another interesting, you know, it's not even a sidebar, but you know, another interesting aspect of you know, James Baldwin's, you know, heritage and legacy.
Yeah, it's you know, you get these mythologies about people. It's neat to hear from people who were there, how talented he was from the start. People recognized it even when he was a young boy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So true. So true. Yeah. Yeah. Ashe, to his memory, we are pouring verbal libations to James Baldwin today and thanking, you know, all the ancestors, you know, that were a part of his creation and the world that inspired him, you know, and all the work that he left. He left a tremendous legacy. Tremendous
mm-hmm.
legacy.
Yes.
You know, that
yes.
we are still uncovering and still mining. And this, it's an example for all of us, you know, that this is what you do. You know, you leave a legacy. That's how you make the world better. You leave a legacy so that, you know, people can read your work and look at your beautiful art forms, listen to your music, and become better human beings.
Yes.
Oh, well yeah. said. Well said. That's not like a crack of the whip for me to get into the art studio, you know. Yes.
Yeah. Well, thank you both so much for joining me today. And I'm going to close with, you know, this Mr. Soul interview. I haven't played it in a while, so hopefully everything is good here. But thank you so much for reminding me of it, Norman, because I had forgotten about Mr. Soul and this wonderful interview that the young Nikki Giovanni, conversation the young Nikki Giovanni had with James Baldwin.
Yeah, no, I'm glad to get the word out. Thank you for thinking of it.
Sure,
and
sure.
Thank you so much for the invitation. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah, so you can share you know, this production with your friends, Baba Denny Zulu, because it's live streamed.
Okay.
So you can be
so,
in
and,
the house
and
tonight.
So what time it'll be on tonight? What time would?
8:00. 8:00.
8:00.
Friday, Saturday, and then 2:00 on Sunday.
Okay. So that's 11:00 Eastern time. Okay. Sounds great. All right.
Well, and if you get a ticket for the live stream, you can, that ticket is good for a week. You can watch it at any time you want once you've got your ticket.
Oh, okay. Okay.
It's been horrible because people say, oh, tell me what the link is. And I'm like, you don't link. You get a ticket, and that's your link. And only the people who have a ticket will get that option of watching it
gotcha.
Even after the production tonight.
Right. Okay.
But yeah, you don't have to stay up for it.
Right. Okay. Right.
And,
yeah,
and
that's innovative.
And I put all of the information in the links for the Mechanics Institute, for the play that Norman is talking about, the inventory, James Baldwin Abroad, August 1st through 4th. And I also put a couple of other things in there that people might not be
yeah.
aware of, some of the things we talked about. So it's all in the description. So.
Great. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Take good care. I look forward to seeing you in the theater. Bye-bye. Thank you so
bye-bye.
Much.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Take good care. All right. A pleasure and an honor.
Too.
Okay, bye-bye.
Well, good to talk to you. Good to hear your voice. Bye-bye.
Yeah.
And tonight on Soul, a conversation between James Baldwin and Nikki Giovanni. And now, here to introduce the program is the producer of Soul, Ellis Hayes.
Good evening. I'm Ellis Haysliff, and I welcome you to another Soul episode. One of the miracles of this universe that we deal with is the way it can use something as cold and gray and as impersonal as an electron. These electrons that fill your television screen to bring you an experience as warm and as rich and as human as the program you're about to see. And we here at Soul are extremely proud that we have been able to put together two programs, conversations between two brilliant and eloquent members of the Black family, Nikki Giovanni and James Baldwin. We had to travel to London in order to tape these programs, and we then edited them to fit within our time schedule of 1 hour. Tonight you will be seeing the first hour of this conversation, and next week we will air the second part. Mr. Baldwin, who is now living abroad, is the author of Going to Meet the Man, Tell Me How Long the Train's Been Gone, The Fire Next Time, Another Country, Nobody Knows My Name, Giovanni's Room, Notes of a Native Son, Go Tell It on the Mountain, and A Rap on Race with Margaret Mead. James Baldwin is also the author of the plays Blues for Mr. Charlie and The Amen Corner. Nikki, as most of our viewers know, is an old friend of Soul's and one of quite a few beautiful people who has always made her time, energy, and thinking available to us. She is the author of Black Feeling, Black Talk, Black Judgment, Recreation, Gemini, and Spin a Soft Black Song. She also edited an anthology of black female voices titled Night Comes Softly. So here now are Nikki Giovanni and James Baldwin in conversation.
Jimmy, I'm really curious. Why did you move to Europe?
Well, when did... Why or when?
Why? I think I know when.
I moved to Europe as far as one can say I did. I moved to Europe first in 1948. Because I was trying to become a writer and couldn't find in my surroundings, in my country, a certain stamina, a certain corroboration that I needed. For example, no one ever told me that Alexander Dumas was a mulatto, and no one had told me that Pushkin was black. And as far as I knew when I was very, very young, there had never been anything, as far as my father knew, which is much more important, there never been anything called a black writer, you know.
Can dig it. <There's you. laughs>
So when I was, you know, when I was 24, I split. I went to, and came to Paris and worked and went home in 57 and worked and stayed and was based in New York, really, in and out, because I was, work is on the one hand making speeches and on the other hand trying to write, you know. And I never was able to write in New York, so I would go out and do my work and come back and do my work, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, I understand.
And that all ended in a way, or something else began, after Martin Luther King was murdered. And I spent a long time in limbo. At the moment, I'm based in the south of France. But there isn't any way ever to leave America. You know, I would be a fool to think that there was some place I could go where I wouldn't carry myself with me, or there was some way for me to live if I pretended I didn't have the responsibilities which in fact I do have. Mm-hmm. So I'm, in a way, just living, I'm a cat trying to make it in the world, because I'm condemned to live in the world.
Condemned?
condemned in the sense that, when you're young and also when you're old, you would rather, you know, have around you, you know, the expected things, you know, to know where everything is, you know. And it's a little difficult, but it's very valuable to be forced to move from one place to another and deal with another set of situations all of the time, and to accept that this is going to be, it is, your life, mm-hmm. and to use it, you know. It means you, in a sense, become neither white nor black, you know, and you learn a great deal about You're forced to learn a great deal about the history out of which all these words and conceptions and flags and martyrdoms
right.
come.
Yeah. There's something that eventually I'm sure we're going to hit, so we're just going to have to work it out.
All right.
Okay, but let's start, let's say, with Everybody's Protest Novel, which I think came out in 48.
It came out in 49, something like that, yes.
When I was six.
Oh, Jesus.
I thought it was a magnificent piece. I went to first grade. I said, my God, somebody's really talking. How do you stand in relationship, say, to that novel now?
To that, to Everybody's Protest Novel, that essay now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what do you think about, let's say, the younger writers, of which I am one? And within that context, are we, in your opinion, like moving ahead? Are we moving out of that basic set of
assumptions? I think it's very difficult to say it. You know, it can be misunderstood. But you have no idea, and I can never express to you to what extent I depend on you, or. I mean you, Nikki Giovanni, and also mean your generation.
My generation, yeah.
You know. I can even say you have no idea, and I can never express that either. Because I have, in a way, I have no right to say it, but I'm very proud of you. Something has moved. Things move in a very strange way, and maybe inexpressible. Mm-hmm. If I wrote that essay today, for example, I would be writing a very different essay out of a very different kind of problem.
Mm-hmm.
I think that without quite realizing it, and no matter what our hang-ups are as of this very moment, the hang-up of my generation or the hang-up of your generation,
mm-hmm.
you know, and the terrible situation in which all of us find ourselves, one thing has changed, and that is the attitude that black people have toward themselves. Now, within that change, I don't want to be romantic about it, a great deal of confusion and incoherence, you know, will go on for a very long time, you know, but that was inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
That moment had to come too, you know. And Everybody's Protest Novel, what I was trying for myself, after all, first of all, to elucidate for myself a theology and the effects of a theology, which I, at that moment, realized I carried in myself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was not the world that was my oppressor only. Because what the world does to you, if the world does it to you long enough and effectively enough, you begin to do it to yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You become a collaborator. An accomplice of your own murderers, mm-hmm. because you believe the same things they do. No, you think they think it's important to be white, and you think it's important to be white.
Mm-hmm.
They think it's shameful to be black, and you think it's shameful to be black. And you have no corroboration around you of any other sense of life. You know, all those corroborations which are around you are, in terms of the white majority standards, so deplorable, they frighten you to death. You don't eat watermelon. No, you get so rigid you can't dance, you know. You can hardly move by the time you're 14,
mm-hmm.
you know. You're always scrubbed and shining. You know, a parody of God knows what, you know, because no white person has been, you know, as clean as you have been forced to become.
Yeah,
and you know, and you've got somehow to begin to break out of all of that and try to become yourself, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard for anybody, but it's very hard if you're born black in a white society. Hard because you've got to divorce yourself from the standards of that society.
Mm-hmm.
The danger of your generation, if I may say so, you know, we'll pursue this like
no.
you like,
no, no.
is to substitute one romanticism for another.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because in fact, these categories are, to put it too simply, but, you know, with a certain brutal truth, these categories are commercial categories.
It's true.
You know, there was a reason that when you and I were slaves, my son, produced out of your body, was by definition a slave.
Mm-hmm.
But the master's son also produced out of your body, depending on his color. If he was light enough, he could live in the big house. And if he wasn't, he took his condition from the condition of his mother.
He was still a slave.
He was a slave. He was a slave. He was a slave because even though he might be the master's son, the master could make money off of his son.
Mm-hmm.
The whole institution was threatened if a slave woman could produce a free man.
Of course.
And the dilemma begins there. Did you see what I mean?
I don't see why it's a dilemma. If
the dilemma began
there.
The
slave woman
was a free man. That
means anything.
A slave woman was forbidden by law. I said the reason for commercial to produce a free man, because once you have a free man out of the body of a slave, you no longer have a slave.
That's true.
You know. But it's very hard to recognize that the standards which have almost killed you are really mercantile standards. They're based on cotton. They're based on oil. They're based on peanuts. They're based on profits.
Yeah, to this day.
To this hour.
Yeah.
Which the church sanctifies.
But the church is commercial.
It's when you begin to realize all of that, which is not easy, that you begin to break out of the culture which has produced you and discover the culture which really produced you. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
What really brought you where you are. When you're in trouble, when I'm in trouble, I do not sing a Doris Day at Tin Pan Alley tune. You find yourself humming and moaning, something which
your
great-grandfathers did. No.
That has to do with
us. That has to do with us.
Yeah.
And what it's all about is the attempt now to excavate something which has been buried,
mm-hmm.
Which you contain and I contain, and which your kid contains, and which has got to carry, which one has to hand down the line for the sake of your kid and for the sake of future generations, and even for the sake of white people who have not the remotest idea what this means. Because we have the edge over the people who think of themselves as white, and that we have never been deluded into believing what they believe. And that sounds like a contradiction.
Yes.
But in fact, you watch the man you work for. You have to watch him. You don't know you're watching him.
You're watching
him. But you're watching him. But he's not watching you. He thinks he knows who you are or what you are.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know who he is because your life is in his hands. And you have to watch him, because if you don't watch him, you might have lived from Monday till Tuesday. It's as simple as that. And without knowing you know him, you know him. He can't fool you.
I'm not at all. I mean, the civil rights movement, I came up in the 60s, which is like way after everybody else. But we always assumed that we knew white people. That we really sort of like understood them. And I found out that if you don't understand yourself,
mm-hmm.
you don't understand anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And all what I mean with the snake is to watch a snake.
Mm-hmm.
And you know it's a snake, but you don't know it.
That's right. That's right.
You know what I mean?
That's right.
Because there's too much between. There's too much emotion.
There's too much fear.
I mean? I can watch like the cat I work for.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And he's going to watch me to some mm-hmm. extent. But we know each other. I would hypothesize that he knows me better because his game is running. Mine's not. And that's what I've sort of always disagreed with your generation on. As long as his game is running, he obviously knows me because he's I'm playing. You understand? He's saying jump and I'm saying how high.
Yeah.
He knows me.
You may be right, but I would put it another way. I would suggest that since his game is running, he hasn't got to know you, because his game is running. You're part of the game he's running. He hasn't got to know you. I would think that one of the reasons that the Americans are in such trouble now is because the game is running. It was running up until only yesterday, really.
Would you believe today?
And all of a sudden, to the American astonishment, the Americans have suddenly discovered that people in the world don't like them.
Yeah.
Now, I always knew that. Because I didn't like some. I love some.
They're not likable. Well, there's two people that are unlikable.
They ain't likable.
And there's two people in the world that's not likable, a master and a slave.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
See?
Exactly. We will never get precise categories for that very loaded statement. but that is where the truth is.
Yeah. How did you like them? So the question, for me, the question has always been power.
Yes.
And for, like you all, the question has been morals. I never wanted to be the most moral person in the world.
I agree, I know.
I would sell my soul, What does it profit a man to gain the world and lose his soul?
Mm-hmm.
The world.
Mm-hmm.
The world, that's what it profits.
I know.
So you take the soul,
I know.
That's spiritual. Take the world, but give me Jesus.
Y'all can have Jesus.
Give me the world. Even though it's losing 25% of its energy every 100 years or something ridiculous.
Oh, please, don't believe all. Don't believe everything you hear.
No, but I'm saying that's not like you're saying.
I know.
Even though it's polluted, ugly, dirty, give it to me. I will take it or not.
But speaking, I agree with you. I agree with you. But speaking for myself, but also speaking as representative of my generation,
mm-hmm.
But it's probably safer to speak only for myself, really. No. I know that in my own case, what I felt and still feel, perhaps in a different way, but what I felt very strongly in the years, for example, when I was, when we all were marching down those dusty highways of Martin. Look, I left the church when I was 17 years old. You know, and I've not really been to a church since, except, you know, when I had to go for various fundraising rallies or this or that. And I was not exactly the kind of Christian that Martin was, if I could be described as Christian at all.
It's hard to be the kind of Christian he was.
But I liked him. I loved him, in fact. And I knew that something was happening through him. And my concern was, yes, the world. But I'd seen what white people had done to the world. And I'd seen what white people had done to their children. You know,
mm-hmm.
Because in gaining the world, they had lost something.
They lost?
No, they'd lost the ability to love their own children.
Or the ability to love themselves.
Which is the same thing, you know. And I didn't want that to happen, if I may say so, to you. It was not a matter of morals so much. As a matter of being forced, in my own case, to suggest, to keep suggesting that, though it was indeed, you know, a matter of power, power without, the word morals is misleading, power without some sense of oneself is simply another kind of sterility, and that black people would then become exactly what white people have become. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's a danger.
You know, I also accept this, that danger is not up to me to tell anybody how to run, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I can only speak as what I am. I'm a kind of poet, and if I'm a kind of poet, then I'm responsible from my own point of view to the people who produced me and the people who will come after me,
mm-hmm.
you know, so that when the Holocaust comes, and it will come, you know, eventually, no matter how simple black and white terms may be today, life is not that simple, and sooner or later, if I do my work as I should do it, when I'm needed, I'll be there. You know what I mean?
I don't know if the people listening, but I know what you mean. Because I think the most important thing for any of us is when what comes, or when what we know will come, comes,
mm-hmm.
that we have the strength to say, yeah, it can.
That's right, it can.
You know?
It can.
And I'm going to stay in my apartment on 94th, and you'll be your niece.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll say, yeah.
And we'll also be able to ride out the storm. But what is more important is not so much the riding out of the storm for you, Nikki, and me, Jimmy.
Mm-hmm.
You know? But in my mind's eye, there's always that kid. He's going to be here when you're gone.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Hopefully.
And when I'm long gone. And my point of view is, it is about the children. It is about the children. We have to give the children something, which in a way was after all given to us, though we had to learn how to translate it. Because your kid will be moving in a very different world than the one in which I grew up, which you won't know anything about at all, or the world in which you grew up, which will be remote for him, mm-hmm. and yet he comes out of it, and has got to carry it much further than you or I will be able to carry it.
He's got to have respect for it, but not be trapped by it.
Precisely. You have to give it to him and liberate him from it. You know.
And I think that kind of thing has been lacking. Like, I think one of the nicest things that we created almost as a generation, and it wasn't us because Martin Delaney and those people were way before us, but just the fact that we could say, hey, I don't like white people.
Mm-hmm. It's a great liberation.
You know, it was a beginning of course,
yeah.
being able to like them.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
Which, of course, it upsets them, but that's their problem.
Yeah, but their problem really is a kind of... We were talking earlier before the show began about the kind of incomprehension in somebody's face, and you're trying to describe what is to you a very simple situation.
Right.
You know, like, people don't like going to jail. And you see the man's face, and he looks astonished. What? People don't like going to jail? And then you and then you pull back.
You mean something?
You know, does that really go on? And you live this all your life. And what you watch is that he knows it, really. He doesn't think that you know it. He doesn't think anybody will tell him. And if it comes in, as we were saying earlier, if he allows that to enter into his guts, he's a very different person. He may explode. He doesn't know what will happen if he allows this apprehension of someone else's experience enter into him.
Right. Because he's perpetuating his experience.
And this is the crisis of the age. This is what Malcolm really meant when he said that white is a state of mind.
Okay.
You know.
On a certain level, because I tend to be parochial, one thing, and I tend to care about Afro-Americans, which I would define as the sons and daughters of slaves and slave owners.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I have
that doesn't, by the way, sound very parochial to me.
It's very parochial because I don't care about my third world brothers and sisters and things like that I'm sure I should. But as we...
You mean you're responsible for a certain situation?
I just can't deal with it.
Yes, I
think that if everybody dealt with their own little situation,
yes.
If I deal with my block and mm-hmm. you deal with your block,
Malcolm
we'll have
said,
two different...
And Malcolm said that too.
Yeah. So when we deal with white as being like a state of... Well, Malcolm said everything, which I would grant. He encompassed. But as we begin to try to deal, you know what I mean, with the world, we find that a lot of things break down. And we find that frequently a white face goes with a white mind.
Mm-hmm.
Occasionally, a black face goes with a white mind.
Mm-hmm.
Very seldom a white face will have a black mind. But we find the frequent situation is a white face has a white mind.
Yeah, but
you know what I mean?
I agree.
That you would make, it's unfortunate.
No, I know.
You know what
I wouldn't,
to me, it's unfortunate.
I wouldn't argue that at all.
Yeah.
No, I wouldn't argue that at all. No, it doesn't make any difference to me. As I said once somewhere, you know, that a cop is a cop.
Well, cops
no.
are white.
And, you know, and he may be a very nice man, but I haven't got the time to figure that out. You know, all I know is he's got a uniform and a gun. You know, and I have to relate to him that way. You know,
really
that's the only way to relate to him mm-hmm. at all. Because one of us is going, you know, one of us may have to die.
One of us, you know, in New York, there's a big campaign going on to humanize the policemen. And they have billboards upstate, and they have a picture of a big cop bending over this little blonde girl.
Mm-hmm.
And the signs say, and some people call him pig.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to buy a billboard. I told a friend of mine, I want to buy a billboard and show this big cop and this 14-year-old kid with 30 bullets in him and saying, some people call him peacemaker. You know?
You have to do one thing Lorraine Hansberry said, get this photograph. When we had that famous meeting with Bobby Kennedy, Lorraine said to Bobby, who was also dead.
Everybody's dead.
You know. Lorraine said to Bobby, in answer to something about black manhood, Jerome Smith had been talking about black men. And Lorraine said she wasn't worried about black men because they'd done very well, all things considered. She was very proud of them. But she told Bobby, she said, I'm very upset about the state of the civilization which produced that photograph of that white cop in Birmingham standing on that black woman's neck.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. What does that say for white manhood? But again, that's a moral position.
Do you follow
what I mean?
Yeah,
moral.
I do.
That means that we're on top of the situation by being on bottom, and many of us
would like to see it the other way around. I'm not quite that romantic, or even if you want to use the word moral, quite that moral. I simply know. I think I know. You know. Look, I'm not a financier. You know, I'm not a banker. I'm not a practical man, so to speak, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm what I am. And I know the choices I've had to make in my own life to be able to shave in the morning, to look myself in the face in the morning. Now, I'm not so moral as to sit here and say that if somebody had a gun pointed at my brother's head, that I would pray for him, you know. I'm not about to tell you, you know, that I'm lighting candles every day and every night for the soul of J. Edgar Hoover, you know.
Yeah.
On one level, I'm not moral at all. I don't care what happens to Hoover and all his tribe at all. But I do care what happens to you. You know,
mm-hmm.
And if I am moral, which I don't really think I am, but you know, it's a word you keep bringing up.
I know.
But the relationship between morality and power is a very subtle one. You know, mm-hmm. Because power, ultimately, with no morality, is not any longer power. You cannot call Spain a powerful nation. You can't call Franco a powerful man. You've got a whole nation in jail, but that's not power.
No.
You know what I mean?
Exactly.
You know.
His game isn't running.
Precisely. Precisely. Now, when our game starts running, and after all, baby, we have survived the roughest game in the history of the world.
Yeah.
You know, we really have. No matter what we say against ourselves, you know, no matter what our limits and hang-ups are, you know, we have come through something, you know. And if we can get this far, we can get further. You know, and we got this far by means which no one understands, including you and me. We're only beginning to apprehend it, and you're a poet precisely because you are beginning to apprehend it and put it into a form, you know, which will be useful for your kid and his kid, you know, and for the world. Because we're not obliged to accept the world's definitions. Just because white people say they're white, we're not obliged to believe it. You know. Just because the Pope says he's a Christian, we're not obliged to believe it.
And we'd be crazy, you know, if we did.
We have to make our own definitions and begin to rule the world that way. Because kids, white and black, cannot use what they have been given. You know?
And they're rejecting it.
They're rejecting it. Nobody wants to become the president of Pan Am, or the governor of California, or Spiro Agnew. The kids want to live.
Yeah.
You know? And we have, out of a terrifying suffering, a certain sense of life which everybody needs. You know? And that's morality for me. You know, use the word morals, I would use the word energy.
Okay.
You see what I mean?
I can follow that, yeah.
You know? Anyway, it's a very mysterious endeavor, isn't it? You know? Because the key is love.
I was going to say, it's hard to figure out black people. And that's, no, really, I mean, you know. You know. Cause
I know.
It's very hard because you say, let's say somebody like you, you've been out of the church for a long time, okay? I grew up, of course, in a Baptist church, and I really dig the church.
I do, too.
I think it's a very cool...
I do, too.
I can't dig the theology, but the music and the energies of the church.
Yes.
But then I went to the New York Community Choir. I had its anniversary recently, its first anniversary, and I went up to an AME Zion church. As a matter of fact, and the lady was singing. Some lady was singing, "Yes, Jesus loves me," and people started shouting. You know what I mean? Yes, Jesus.
Yeah.
People were shouting, and it hit me as I was sitting there. My God, as a so-called black militant, I have nothing stronger to offer than Jesus.
Yeah, and but you see, it? Yeah, but yeah, but you, baby.
And that was a mind. It blew. As a matter of fact, every church said, "Ain't that a bitch?" And then I was testifying, "Ain't that?" It blew my mind.
Baby, what we did with Jesus was not supposed to happen. You know,
I
at
could
all.
Believe that.
No.
Yeah.
We took that cat over and made him ours. He has nothing whatever to do with the white Jesus in Montgomery, Alabama, in that white church. We did something else with him. We made him ours. Something in us knew that he was always really a nigger. Because, you know, Swedes don't come from Israel. You know. You had to be fairly dark.
Well, white people really deal more with God. And black people move with Jesus.
No, they don't even deal with God. You know, they don't deal with God. They deal with... God for them seems to be some metaphor for purity and for safety. You know, the whole heart of the Christian legend is always... And sometimes impressing as being, you know, really obscene. And it's the key to all the dirty jokes which come afterwards. You know, can you imagine what would happen to you, Nikki? I'm married to you. I go out to work. I come home. You say to me, "Baby, you know what happened today?" I said, "No, what happened?" "Well, you know, the Holy Ghost came by." "Oh, he did, did he?" "And, Joe, no. The Holy Ghost whispered in my ear, I'm pregnant." Now, I might look a little hard at you. If I were really vulnerable, I might try to find that cat, the Holy Ghost. This has been believed by millions of people.
Yeah, they really
who lived
do.
And died by it for 2,000 years. Yeah. And when you attack it, you're accused of being blasphemous. I think the legend itself is a blasphemy.
Yeah.
What is wrong with a man and a woman sleeping together, making love to each other, and having a baby like everybody else?
It's true. It's not only...
Why is the Son of God got to be born immaculately? Aren't we all the sons of God? That's a blasphemy.
But we're not all the sons of God.
Well, it depends on what you mean by God.
Depends on who's doing it.
I claimed him as my father. And I'll give him a great, great vow of you now and the time until it's over. Because God is our responsibility.
Well, I agree with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of people don't realize. They think that we are God's responsibility.
No.
But it's one of him and, what, 30 million of us.
That's right. And God's only hope is us.
That's true.
No. If we don't make it, he ain't going to make it either.
He'd be in bed. Now, people are funny about sex, which I never understood.
Well, they're terrified of it. Same way people are. It's not about sex, either. It's not about sex. You know, sex is not really the problem. Love is the problem. You know, when you're a kid, when you're a 16-year-old boy, 15-year-old boy, you know, what does he want, really? He wants release.
15-year-old girl.
And there's nothing yet at that moment yet to do really with love, because love is something which comes much later, really. You know, a kid loves you in a certain way because he needs you.
Mm-hmm.
But later on, when you're a man or a woman, it has to be much more reciprocal. You love somebody because you need each other.
Right.
But this is not, one's not capable of this idea, you know, when you're 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, when everything is sexual and everything is being discovered, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's why so many of our kids turn into junkies, which we won't go into at the moment.
Okay, but let's
come
back.
We'll come back to it, you know. But the great question is not that. The great question is, you see, if... It seems to me that the black male, situation of the black male, is in microcosm, the situation of the Christian world. The price of being a black man in America, God bless you.
I'm sorry.
It's all right.
It's the weather.
The price you had to pay, the price you're expected to pay, and which you have to outwit, is your sex. No, a black man is forbidden by definition, since he's black, to assume the roles, the burdens, the duties, and the joys of being a man. In the same way that my child producing your body does not belong to me, but to the master. He could be sold at any moment.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
I can follow that.
Hmm? And this erodes a man's sexuality. When you erode a man's sexuality, you destroy his possibility to love anybody. You know, though sex and love are not the same thing, if a man's sexuality is gone, then his possibility, his hope of loving, is also gone. You know.
He has no way to express. He has limited ways.
He has absolutely no floor in which to dance, no room in which to move, no way to get from one day to the next. Because they make love to you. It's not the same thing as taking you. You know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a journey which most people have got to make. With each other.
But why do black men, why do we allow this to happen?
Look, when one begins to talk about, when I begin to talk about, you know, the situation of black men, I mean, anyone, I'm nearly 50, so that I've got to avoid sounding, you know, in any way defensive, because...
I don't mean that
I think you're attacking me, but... You ask me a question which I'm trying to answer as honestly as I can. I have to look back over my own life.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And you save yourself, if you have any sense at all, and if you're lucky enough. You know, if you lose your center, and let's say the center is your sex, if you lose that, if you allow that to be destroyed, then everything else is gone. And you have to figure out a way of saving it from the landlord. Because after all, I had to watch my father and what my father had to endure to raise 9 children on $27.50 a week when he was working. Now, when I was a kid, I didn't know what the man was going through at all. I didn't know why, you know, he was always in a rage. I didn't know why he was impossible to live with, but I had not had to go through yet his working day.
Mm-hmm.
And he couldn't quit his job because he had the kids to feed. You know, he couldn't say, as you know, as our kids can, I don't like white people. He couldn't say anything. He lived his whole life in silence except in the church, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he couldn't explain, how can you explain to a 5-year-old kid, you know, my boss, you know, called me a nigger and I quit. and the kid's belly's empty, and you see it, you know, and you got to raise a kid. You know, you've got to raise a kid, and your manhood is being slowly destroyed hour by hour, day by day. Your woman's watching it. You're watching her watch it, you know, and the love that you have for each other is being to be destroyed hour by hour and day by day. It's not her fault. It's not your fault. But there it goes, because the pressures under which you live are inhuman. My father finally went mad. And I understood when I became a man how that could happen. It wasn't that he didn't love us. He loved us. It wasn't that he didn't love his wife, our mother. He loved her. But he couldn't take it. Day after day and hour after hour being treated like a nigger on that job and in those streets and on those subways, and then coming home to his children, he didn't understand him at all, mm-hmm. who were moving further and further away from him because they were afraid of him, and also, which is even worse, afraid of the situation, the condition which he represented. He was, after all, for a kid, you begin to see when you're called a nigger, you look at your father because you think your father can rule the world. Every kid thinks that, you know, and your father cannot do anything about it. And then you begin to despise your father and you realize, oh, that's what a nigger is. And it's not your father's fault. And it's not your fault. It's the fault of the power, people who hold the power, because they have deliberately trained your father to be a slave. And they deliberately calculated that if he is a slave, you will be a slave. You will also accept it, and it will go on forever, and slavery will last 1,000 years, which slaveholders said and believed. And now the bill is in, and they want from me or from you sympathy and understanding. I understand it all too well, and I have all the sympathy in the world. That spiritual disaster. But I have no pity. The bill is in. We paid it. Now it's your turn.
It's like a funny situation to be in. Because, like, we were poor, but maybe unfortunately for somebody like me, not poor enough to relate to it. And that, you know, we had enough to eat it like that. Things like that. So that my relationship to that whole syndrome, which remains true, I'm 28 to this day, is that I really don't understand it. I don't understand how one hand, you say you're talking about like a black man, that he can be nothing in the streets and so fearful in his home, that he can be brutalized by some white person somewhere and then come home and treat, you know what I mean, the same way that he was being treated. Which perpetuates, I mean, you take somebody like me, I'm not married, right?
Yes, but Nikki,
I couldn't play my mother.
Yes, I know.
You know what I mean? I just couldn't deal with it. I said, this won't work.
But Nikki, it is also true that since your mother played that role, you haven't got to.
I couldn't.
But you haven't got to. That's the point. Because she did.
But her mother did.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes, but that's how we got here. What I really am trying to say is I don't want us to underestimate the price paid for us.
I have a great deal of respect for those people, for my parents, for people that I don't know, for the whole, you know, everybody who shuffled. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that it's a phenomenon to me how you could be mistreated and then come home and mistreat someone the same way. In order
Well, first of all, Nikki, you say mistreated, or I say mistreated. No. But in the mind of the person who is doing it, he's not mistreating you.
Well, I'm not dealing with that.
Well,
let's not for a minute. Let's say in the mind of, let's say, your father, who is just an example,
mm-hmm,
or the mind
mm-hmm,
of my father,
mm-hmm,
you know what I mean? He is being mistreated. I'm
mm-hmm,
not going to deal with the cracker that's mistreating him.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to deal with him.
Mm-hmm.
He knows that he is not being treated with the respect due him
mm-hmm,
as a person,
mm-hmm,
as a black man.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In order to, like, get that together, when
mm-hmm,
he comes into that house,
mm-hmm,
he begins to, like, brutalize my mother,
mm-hmm,
for example.
Mm-hmm.
You see
mm-hmm,
what I mean? Which
mm-hmm,
becomes, like, a phenomenon to me. Because I don't like white people and I'm afraid of black men, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you could follow what I'm saying without anybody
well,
writing a letter and saying sister, you know what
yeah,
I mean?
Yeah, but you can...
Okay, so what do you do?
Listen, you have to...
It's a cycle.
Of course it is, but you see, this is one of the reasons I don't protest, but try to make clear that the words white and black don't mean anything. No. A man comes home. No. He is in a situation which he cannot control. He is a human being. It's got to come out somewhere. A poor Puerto Rican several years ago, for example. No. It's alleged. But I can see if this happened, why it happened. Cat came home and the 3-month-old baby was screaming, and, you know, as babies do. And he killed it. He didn't mean to kill it. He picked it up and threw it against the wall.
Yeah,
he didn't mean to kill it. It wasn't that. I understand, you know, because I've been there. I know something about that. I don't know if it happens to a woman, but it happens to a man. You cannot do anything. They got you. They got you by the throat and by the balls. And of course it comes out. And it comes out, where would it come out? It comes out in the person closest to you.
I was going to say, that's so wrong, because what you perpetuate...
Nikki, it may be wrong.
I hate to use those kind of terms.
But Nikki, it may be wrong. Of course it's wrong. But we're dealing with human beings. You know, one cannot be romantic about human nature. One cannot be romantic about one's own nature.
I don't think that I'm romantic. But
no, I don't mean that you are.
I have seen how the community, and even today in 1971, even today there are divisions based on those same...
Yes,
kind of problem.
That's right.
So that the black men say, in order for me to be a man, you walk 10 paces behind me. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well,
it means nothing. I can walk 10 paces behind a dog. It means nothing to me. But if that's what he needs, I'll never get far enough behind him for him to be a man. You know what I mean?
Look,
I'll never walk that slowly.
Look, Nikki, if at the risk of, at the very great risk of pulling, seeming to pull rank.
Oh.
You know.
Pull rank. You know.
I'm not.
Go
I'm
on.
I'm not. No. But no, I don't mean that. But,
no.
What I do mean is that I've, a great many things which seem, if I may say so, new to you, are not new to me.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I can say then, okay, I see what the cat's doing, and how long I can tell you almost exactly how long he will do it. You know, I know that a great deal of what passes for black militancy right now is nothing but a fashion. You know,
at best.
You know, at best. Something will rest. Something will remain. What is important about it is not the details, not the given, you know, people, you know, or the given so-called leaders or any of that jazz, you know. What is important is the impulse out of which it has come, the ferment out of which it has come, which it reveals to, and what's valuable in it will remain, and the rest will go.
Yeah, but what's...
You know what I mean?
Yeah, but... Again, what's sort of sad to me is that the same syndrome that, say, our father set up,
mm-hmm.
coming from many, you know what I mean? My father is your age.
Mm-hmm.
And the same syndrome
Jesus.
That they set up, well, you know, he's a little
yeah.
bit older, 55. But
a
the
little
same,
bit older, 55. Thank you, baby.
Well, 7 years older. The same syndromes which is being set up, is being perpetuated,
mm-hmm.
is that once again, the black man is becoming the figure to slide away from. You know what I mean? That once again, the black man is the figure that you say, well, I can't handle that. And if you visit with the states, or, you know, you talk to people enough, you'll see that same syndrome, you know, the little guys that
mm-hmm.
are standing around crossing
mm-hmm.
their arms,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
they're not lovable. They're not giving any love. They could give a damn about me. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
and that's unfortunate, because I need love.
Yes, but sweetheart, what you're saying is very, very serious. I'm not in the least denying it, because you're perfectly right. But the only way we can get through it, I think, is it's demanding a great deal of you. But one's got no choice but demanding a great deal of you. Is that you understand? Look, let us say I'm King Oliver.
All right.
Right? And I'm a pretty good musician.
Very good musician.
Mm-hmm. And somebody called, let us say, Bing Crosby.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. No, who couldn't carry a tune from here to here, right?
Right.
Right?
It's true.
Now I watch this little white boy become a millionaire. Become a millionaire. Many times over, I can't get a job. You know, and time goes on. you get older, you get more weary. And since you cannot get a job, your morale begins to be destroyed, and the body begins to fail you. Your death approaches. All because, being a man, you've never been able to execute what a man ought to be able to do. And this is not anything that you have done or not done by some arbitrary sentence. How in the world, if I can't get a job, if I can't even get my axe out of the pawn shop, if I can't even get money to get on the subway, how am I going to love anybody except in such an awful pain and rage that nobody could bear it? I'm not trying to defend it. I'm trying to make you see it.
Yeah.
You see what I mean?
I do, but because maybe I'm hopeful or because I've structured my life in a way that I won't...
I don't, by the way, think that what I'm describing is any longer true for your generation. I don't mean that.
But I see the same, what I keep saying is that I see the same syndromes in the same guys that I have to deal with now.
Yes, but my dear, what you have to see is also, think about the kid, you know. What you're going through is one thing, and I'm not trying to minimize it. I don't even mean you personally.
Yeah, the generation,
no.
It's not.
Yes, I don't mean you, Nikki, exactly.
No, I hope that nobody,
no.
I'm not talking about
no,
me that
no,
much.
No, I know. But what I do mean is that, simply assume, for the moment, the kid is a useful metaphor because it carries you past one moment.
Into the next.
Into another moment. Because no matter what happens to me or to you, one's responsibility is somewhere else. So it's a terrible Tuesday and a wretched Friday. But, you know, you still... The kid don't know that. And then you begin to see... Then you begin to see that what looks so awful on Wednesday or on Friday, or is so awful, is awful, but it's not eternal. You can get through it.
Hopefully.
And when you get through it, you can understand it.
Okay. We're not like in disagreement. What I'm trying to maybe get you to relate to is that, and I lay it on black men because I'm a black woman.
You have every right to.
I'm sure it's that arbitrary.
No, you have every right to.
But a guy, let's say a guy's going with girl.
Mm-hmm.
You're going with Maybelle. And Maybelle gets pregnant. All of a sudden, you can't speak to Maybelle because you don't have the money for a crib, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
She doesn't need a crib. The baby's going to sleep someplace. If you can follow me for 2 seconds. Wait. The baby's going to sleep someplace. The baby's going to eat something. But what she needs at that moment is a man.
Mm-hmm.
And in order, if the man functions as a man,
mm-hmm.
which is not necessarily a provider for all that stuff, because
mm-hmm.
everybody can understand why you can't buy something. You don't have a job. You didn't have a job when you were always going to bed.
Mm-hmm.
Why are you going to get a job? Because she got pregnant. You understand? There's no job. But what she needs is a man to come by and say, hey, baby, you look good. And black men refuse to function like that. Because they say, I want to bring the crib when I come.
Baby,
you're never going to get the crib.
Baby.
Bring
baby,
yourself.
Baby, I agree with you. I understand what you're saying. You know, but let me tell you this. You know, you may be absolutely right, and you are right from your point of view.
It's arbitrary.
But you have to understand my point of view.
I'm trying.
You know, and from my point of view, well, if you were pregnant, I would act very differently. But that's me, that's something else. But from the man's point of view, given the fact, as we said much earlier, that the standards of the civilization into which you were born are first outside of you. And by the time you get to be a man, they're inside of you. And this is not susceptible to any kind of judgment. It's a fact. If you're treated a certain way, you become a certain kind of person. If certain things are described to you as being real, they're real for you, whether they're real or not. And in this civilization, a man who cannot support his wife and his child is not a man. And this is also in the, for example, in the welfare rules. you know.
Yeah.
The black man has always been treated as a slave, and of course he reacts that way, one way or another, you know. And you can blame him on a human level if you like, but I think it's more interesting to not try to, you have to understand it, the bag the cat is in.
But it's so...
You know, because how can I... You know, this is, I'm not being rational. You know, I may love you, especially if I love you. How in the world am I can't come with nothing?
But it's not,
I know it doesn't make any sense, Nikki, but
no,
a man is built like that.
You see, when we talk about the children, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we talk about, like, let's say my little boy,
mm-hmm.
your nephew,
mm-hmm.
something like that. We talk about you. How are we going to create the new child in the same old syndrome?
Well,
somebody
well,
has to fake it
first,
enough. You understand? Somebody has to say, hell no, I can't buy you a bicycle. You don't need one. And
yes.
smile about
but
it
some,
so the kid can say, I'm not afraid
but
of daddy.
But sometimes that happens, and after all.
But not enough to talk about, when we talk about the group.
Yeah, but wait.
We're talking about the group.
Hold the phone, baby. You know, it has begun. Something has begun. The fact that we're talking about it is a beginning.
It's very important.
You know, it's very important indeed. Look, I've had to learn in my own life, you know, I want this. And I want it Friday. And Friday comes and I work my behind off to get something done that I don't come. It doesn't come for 20 years. Then you use that 20 years. Look, life is a very short and very long time. It is, really it is, you know. And it's very important not to get hung up on any given detail, because what is there, like the fact that you're a woman and the fact that I'm a man, that's going to be there forever, and we're going to have to deal with that forever.
From the beginning,
you know.
Sure.
And we have to deal with it from day to day, you know. Because if we love each other, we both know it. The tragedy is we both know it. And the greater tragedy is that it's destroyed by things which have nothing to do with you and nothing to do with me. A man is built as he's built, and there's nothing one can do about that. A man is not a woman.
That's true.
You know, and whether he's wrong or right, look, if we're living in the same house, and you're my wife or my woman, I had to be responsible for that house. And I'm not allowed to be responsible for that house. I'm no longer in my own eyes. It doesn't make any difference what you may think of me. In my own eyes.
That's fair.
I'm not a man.
That's fair.
You see what I mean?
It does indeed make a difference what I think about it. Because I could be perfectly willing, and as a matter of fact, I am perfectly willing to concede that, first of all, a man is a natural aggressor. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I don't care if I walked up to you and said, let's go to bed.
Mm-hmm.
You are the aggressor.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Because it all depends on you.
Mm-hmm.
I could fool myself. I could fool my friend.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I got him.
Mm-hmm.
It depended on you.
Mm-hmm.
You
mm-hmm.
see? So I'm never confused on that level.
Yeah, but...
I've seen so many people get so hung up in such crappy, superficial kind of things that for lack of being able to bring a steak in the house, they won't come. I can get my own damn steak.
Nikki,
I need you.
Nikki,
and that's what the black... No, really, I mean,
yeah,
that's to me what the black
yeah,
man...
Yeah, but Nikki, you're perfectly right. But you're being... but you're being perfectly rational.
But it's a rational situation.
Yeah, but love is not a rational situation.
Love must be. It must be rational. Because this irrationality that we have does
Look,
not
when I was
work. It destroys people.
I quite agree with you, but this is something we have to confront. When I was 22, I was about to get married. And for several reasons, I threw my wedding rings in the river, and that was when I split. You know, decided I would leave. I didn't get married partly because I had no future. It's very, very important.
You had
you know,
no future.
I had no
right,
future.
Sure.
No, you got to go back to where I was.
Yeah, 22.
You know,
okay.
I had no future. I couldn't keep a job, you know, because I couldn't stand the people I was working for. And there wasn't, nobody could call me a nigger. It's not a small, you know.
Yeah, a little
bit. No. So I split, you know. Now, I love that girl, and I wanted children. But I already had 8. And they were all starving.
Yeah.
And from my point of view, it would have been an act of the most criminal irresponsibility to bring another mouth into the world which I could not feed.
Yeah, but see, those weren't your children. Those were your father's children.
My father was dead.
That's not the
And
point.
As far as they knew then...
That's not what you... One cannot... And I'm not knocking your
I'm,
life. You know
I'm
what
not,
I mean?
I'm
I
not,
could, but one cannot be responsible for what one has
I
not produced.
I said we are not being rational.
But I said we must. I mean, that's my quarrel with the world. We must become rational.
Those are my brothers and sisters.
They were your brothers
rational
and sisters.
Rational or not. They were
but
starving.
They were your father's children
but
and
they,
your mother's children.
That was my father's responsibility. As far as I was concerned, they belonged to me.
Do you know what your life, and I'm saying it like that.
You know what I mean?
I'm trying to, do you know what your life looks like, though? And this is what's happening also today. It looks like a black man can't make it with a black woman. If somebody looks at the two of us, man, we're the weirdest looking people on earth because you went your way and I went my way. Which is saying the same thing, and that's sort of a shame.
I can't have
a black man standing with me, and you can't have a black woman because we wouldn't be who we are if we had. That's the fact.
But Nikki, we are, nevertheless, we are here. We met.
Oh, you and I met.
Yeah.
But I'm talking about for the statement, man. You're looking like a Huey Newton.
Yeah.
He can't make it with a black... Who could be his woman?
We don't know...
Oh, it's such a shame.
We don't know that much about the man.
We know what the image...
Yeah, but...
We know what the...
But
what,
you,
what,
but
we've, what we've seen.
Let us forget the image. We don't know anything at all about the man.
We know a little bit.
Let us assume we don't.
Okay, let us assume we don't.
No. If, insofar as it's true, if it's true... That Huey, for example, cannot make it with a black woman. I don't know that that's true.
I don't know that it's true. I'm saying that to date.
That is part of the trap to make one believe that. I don't believe that myself. No. It's part of a societal illusion which you're expected to believe so that you can react to it and be distracted from the main point, which is one's relationship to each other.
We've come to the end of the first part of this two-part dialogue between Nikki and Jimmy, which, as I told you earlier, we taped in London recently and edited for showing at this time. We hope you all will be able to be with us next week when Nikki Giovanni and James Baldwin continue their conversation. Until next week, then, this is Ellis Haslip saying good night from Seoul.
Oh, wow. I haven't heard that in so long. It was so wonderful. Baba, Benny Zulu, are you still here?
I am.
Wasn't that lovely?
It was awesome. It was awesome. I had to be in and out, but I was catching more snippets of it than I missed. I mean, so many good points, and how each of them just brought out the, you know, the wisdom of the other. That's classic.
Yeah, it is. And I'm trying to think, did I just go in, did a search and just found all these episodes? Because I found quite a few episodes of Mr. Soul. There was actually, I don't know if it was on public broadcasting, but there was a screening of these old shows. But then I think they were available in... in the commons. So I would totally suggest that people go try to do a search for Mr. Soul and see which ones of these episodes you can pull up. We didn't mention Maya Angelou, but but I believe that she and Baldwin were friends and close.
Very close.
But, and you know,
very close friends. Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Because remember when Malcolm X was killed, she got really depressed. And I'm trying to remember, wasn't it Baldwin that went to her house? I'm trying to who went to her house and helped her, you know, sort of.
Oh, okay. That part I don't remember. Of course, the part that stands out with her is that on the day that she was preparing to celebrate her 40th birthday in New York, that very day is when Martin Luther King got assassinated in Memphis. And
oh, that might have been when King was killed. No, but I think it was Malcolm, too. I have to go back and watch
that
film.
Yeah.
Because you know that film that they did of her that was really wonderful?
Maya Angelou and Still I Rise.
Right,
that was
right.
That's a really wonderful documentary. I think they talk about it in that film, so I have to go back and listen. And you know, the answer to my question, you know, send me an email. you can email me through the site.
Yeah. Your memory is so much better than mine. You know, you stay around long enough for you know. I can remember what happened 40 years ago, but I can't remember what happened 40 minutes ago. Yeah.
I want to
just thank you so much. Thank you so much for sharing that and making the centennial so, you know, so much more meaningful, you know. I have to just say, I mean, you know, not because I'm talking to you. I always like to say, I won't say anything about you that I wouldn't say to you.
I just want to let you know that we're still on the air. Okay.
Okay. Yes. And all the better, because I just want to, you know, commend you. I just kind of momentarily reminisce on the tribute that, you know, you were able to put together that we all did for Bea Richards, you know.
We really
have to remember these ancestors and do what you're doing today. So, you know, we don't know how many people listened, but we do know that everybody who did listen was enlightened more than they were before they heard it. So, you know, I just take this opportunity to thank and commend and encourage you to keep up the awesomely good work you do, you know.
Oh, you're quite welcome. And I was thinking, you know, everyone, you know, is not an ancestor. We have a lot of people that are, you know, 100 years old plus. And one of my dear friends, Sister Sadie Williams, made 100 in February 25th, I believe. And so she had a big, you know, celebration, and she is a Union woman. Her husband, Brother Cleophas Williams, was the first black president of the International Longshoremen Union here in San Francisco. And so her party was at the Union Hall in San Francisco, and it was just, like, amazing. And she's active in the retirement part, you know, I guess, organizational part of the union, and she just got back from traveling to Toronto giving a talk, and it's just like, you know, she is so inspiring. My other
so
friend,
awesome.
his mother,
if her birthday was the 25th of February, then she and I share the same one. Mm-hmm. So that's great. Let me know I'm in good company. But anyway, go ahead.
Are you saying that's your birthday? You that's your birthday too?
Uh-huh. So,
Really? Wow, so we were celebrating you. Oh, my gosh, that's typical. Oh, wow. Well, happy birthday on purpose now.
February 25th.
Oh my goodness, yeah. I think you were born in 42, so you made 82, right?
That's right.
Yeah,
the class of 42 was there. The class of 42 was quite, you know, Aretha, Bernice Reagan, Muhammad Ali, a lot of icons came out of that year. Yeah.
Oh, Bernice Reagan was born in 42 too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, she just crossed over.
Oh, yeah, okay, good memory. And Muhammad Ali, really? Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That was a great year for black folks. Man, all these stars coming onto the planet and the universe, like, dropping down
right.
from heaven, right? Like,
right.
Okay.
Right.
Whoa, what a light you all are. My goodness.
Yeah.
We're in a heck of darkness, right?
Yeah.
Wow.
Right. You know,
wow.
Just, yeah, Yeah, it's like the month of April, you know, that all these people, you know, and you got to say, well, what, you know, what happened in July, you know, 9 months earlier, that, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, Billie Holiday, Bessie Smith, Duke Ellington, Charles White, I mean, on and on, for so many, Paul Robeson, I mean, all these people that, you know, came forth in the month of April. So,
mm-hmm.
but I guess, you know, the universe works that way.
Yeah, you know, there's no accident, you know, it's real purposeful, you know, like in Octavia Butler's, prophetic work, Parable of the Sower, you know, her character, protagonist, Oya Olamina, you know, July 20th, 2024, which was written in 1993, you know, she says God has changed, and the way that we participate in the divinity is that we, you know, we change. And so the perspective changes as we change it, you know?
Right.
And that's, so, you know, we're not stuck ever. We're not ever stuck, ever.
No. And, you know, and I think, you know, so much of that ancestral wisdom that you know, is coming to light is, you know, I mean, nothing, not the slave ship, not the slavery itself, not the lynch mob, nothing could destroy that core wisdom. And, you know, some years back, we met an Afro-Cuban Yoruba priest, and he had a shop called the House of Miracles. And out of curiosity, we went in, and anyway, after you know a lot of talking about just different things, you know, he totally unrelated to anything we were talking about, just suddenly says, you know, that whole part of history that we call the slave trade, with all the horror, all the suffering, all the death, that was how the ancestors saw fit to bring us here, because the African presence, the African genius were absolutely required to be here to keep this from becoming a disaster that would have been beyond human imagination. I mean, it was quite a statement. And it was, for me, it was kind of life-changing, because it was like I had been saying thinking for years that, like, we were the only people that were in this country for a purpose that wasn't our own. And, well, here was somebody saying, no, there was a purpose. And I really had to ponder that for quite a while and then, you know, and think about how so – you know, we boarded those slave ships as, you know, Wolof and Yoruba and Igbo and Lante and, you know, Mum and all these, you know. And those who survived came out of the ship as, you know, incipient African Americans. I mean, that horror, that torture, just sort of, and I make no excuse for it, but it really kind of, you know, all the old divisions that we had back there were just erased, and we had to just bring forth the pure essence of what kind of knowledge, strength, and spirituality could enable people to survive that. And I like the fact that in the interview with James Baldwin and Nikki, you know, he makes a point that, you know, I've made and I've heard made that, you know, with all the madness that you see in our community, we came through something that I don't know how many people, you know, could ever have come through. And, and the fact that, you know, people could come out of that and live, laugh, love, give life to new generations, create music and art and humor and this is, you know, and essentially, I mean, in addition to the hard labor, that's what built and saved the country. I mean, you know, when we really think about it. This is I think it's something that we're getting more and more opportunities to see. And, you know, the fact that the National Black History theme this year is African Americans in the arts. And, you know, when we mm-hmm. think about how creativity is, and this goes right to, you know, celebrating James Baldwin again. You know, it's in our creativity that we really create those real spaces where it's beyond religious beliefs, it's beyond ideologies, it's beyond lies we've been told. It taps us into, you know, a real truth. And, you know, you mentioned Maya Angelou, and we were fortunate and blessed to attend her big, it was her 75th birthday bash that Oprah threw for her in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And it was like a 3-day event. And on the Sunday mm-hmm. morning, they decorated one of the buildings. It was on this old tobacco estate. They decorated it like a church and had kind of a church service. And, you know, there were people there, Reverend, you know, from Glide Memorial, you know, the pastor at the time.
Yeah,
right.
Right. Yeah.
Thank you. Yes. And, the Winans and Natalie mm-hmm. Cole were there. And then Jesse Norman, the soprano, mezzo-soprano. When her time came, she comes in from the back of the room. She's wearing this mm-hmm. long dress and this bonnet like she's back in the 1800s. And she's singing, "Oh, Freedom," "Oh, Freedom mm-hmm. over me. Before I'll be a slave, I'll be buried in my grave and go home to my Lord and be free." And, I mean, that was always, to me, one of the more moving anthems of the civil rights movement and all. But, I'm like everybody else, you know, watching this as a performance. And then, you know, I don't know what note she hit, what word she said. All of a sudden, I mean, I'm just, tears are cascading down my face. I'm just a blubbering, and it's like, I'm thinking, oh my goodness, this is, you know, embarrassing. But it was like, well, there's no time to think about silly stuff like that. But it just opened, it was kind of like it just opened up just this deep, quiet, meditative space or, you know, and I was so glad to find out afterwards that I wasn't the only one who had experienced that. And it was just mm-hmm. one more example. And, you know, I've seen many with visual arts, you know, people, how transformative that can be. And I think that's a lot of what James Baldwin did, you know, not just with the product of, you know, like, the book in your hand and the printed word on the page, but the, you know, the process, the kind of the performance, the example that he set, you know, doing that. And it says to me that this is where something that we really need to, as a society and a culture, that we need to attend to a lot more, you know, encouraging our young people. You know, every time your school systems go through any kind of budget crunch, the first thing they cut is art, music, and all the only courses where the kids learn to not find out who they are, you know, not just the mm-hmm. subject, you know, like history and mathematics, not that those are not important. But, you know, it's a gross error to treat art as like playtime, you know. Well, if you're mm-hmm. good, you'll do art on Friday afternoon when nobody's paying attention anyway, you know. And, you know, when we, you know, I belong to the National Conference of Artists that we're in the process of reviving to back to its full strength. And that was just one of the, you know, that was founded in 1959 by some of the, you know, iconic, you know, old masters at the time. And it had to do with that very point that we're, you know, the background we come out of, art was not something superficial or secondary. I mean, it informed everything we did. And you know, I think of Michael Jackson performing in Los Angeles and bringing the two rival gangs together in the same place, and they just had to piece that out. And you know, and Bob Marley bringing those two, you know, Sega and Manly, where people are killing each other in the street over who going to vote for who, and have them, and it just lets us know, you know, this creative spirit, this ability that we brought with us in our invisible baggage, as they say, aboard slave ships, and so many millions of lives were sacrificed for it to get here and be here so that we could be, you know, applying that today to not just our own, you know, but, you know, saving our race, which is the human race, you know, is, you know, something pretty deep. And you know, just circles back to why I'm just so appreciative that, because nobody else had brought it to my attention, that you were able to, you know, pause and, you know, give us and your listeners a chance to just appreciate James Baldwin and then, you know, as we say, you know, we look at all these star athletes and, you know, we say, you know, for every superstar, there's probably at least 20 others that are just, you know, some are incarcerated, some are, you know, they're just in other situations. So you know, it's our time to change the narrative and really be proactive rather than reactive. You know, it's one of those. You know, I've pointed out in a few presentations how, you know, what I call the R words. You know, resistance and rebellion and revolt and runaway and all of those things that they're mm-hmm. they're such empowering words because they let us know that our ancestors didn't just passively accept, you know, their enslavement, you know, they had resilience and all that. But those are also reactive words. Those are words that's looking at our ancestors' actions from the point of view of the oppressor. It's like they are resisting, they are, you know. And no, we are affirming our humanity. We're affirming that that we are, you know, divine, that we are, you know, you know, we weren't born here to be anybody, brought here to be anybody's slave, or born here to be anybody's, you know. And I think that there's an important distinction to be made there. And I think that just might be our generation's legacy to the next generation of the ones to come, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be a good legacy. Yeah, that would be great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 Well, why don't you tell our audience, because I didn't give you a really proper introduction, why don't you tell our audience about some of your projects and how they can, you know, be aware of what you're involved in, like any websites or whatever.
Okay. Maybe I should start by saying I've taken on way too many for the time I have left on the planet. But a lot of what I've been doing include, I do visual art and I do writing and that kind of thing. And a lot of it is centered around, you know, the middle passes. I mean, I think there's something that is so central about that transformative experience. You know, we've talked about the spaceship as being the violated womb that gave birth to new African peoples, the crucible, the fire that we forged into new identities, and all of those kinds of metaphors. But it's so much of a key. And, you know, I'm originally from New York. I've been living in Miami. This year is actually 50 years. In fact, this week or next week will be the 50th anniversary of my arrival here. I thought I'd be here, for months. But it was so, I guess, one of those spiritual things that I don't think it was fully 2 weeks after I was here and I was in this bookstore and, I kind of challenged them to, where's your black section? And they had a very good one and all that. And I found, and I stumbled on this book called History of American Sailing Ships. I fully expected, they're not going to talk about, the ships that brought us. And then I said, here's a whole chapter. And because the book was really about kind of how, evolution of ship design and stuff like that. It was, very more technical. But they had a lot of drawings, like blueprint type drawings, and here was a design plan of an actual one of all those thousands of ships that were engaged in that human trafficking. Here was one where the design plan survived. And in that same split second of seeing that image, it was like I was told that, if we have the plans, we need to build this. We have to build a replica that tells the story from our perspective. And I can't say I've dedicated myself to it with all the energy that would have had it done by now, but then we know how some things are. They're more of a journey than a destination, if you will. But now I'm really hoping to, I've been, casting about for, young minds with real good technical skills to see about how we can do a virtual version of this so that it would, our tagline on that project is, to make it an international traveling museum, an educational resource center, and an ancestral memorial shrine. And I say our because I've got a partner on this. He kind of joined me when he found out he had the same interest that I had, Harmon Carey in Wilmington, Delaware, he was the founder of the Afro-American Historical Society of Delaware and all of that. And we've been working on that, and that sort of has informed like a lot of the art I produce, a lot of, what I've, written about. We've done some, I'd like to think, really meaningful exhibitions, art exhibitions around that theme. We did one in 2007 or 8. Because that was the bicentennial of the abolition of the slave trade, not slavery, but the slave trade. And we did one called Speak the Unspeakable, which was it made the point. We did others. So that's one aspect. The other aspect of that same thing is that Miami, I think, New York might have been the first place to start doing these annual remembrances, ancestral remembrances in the Middle Passage. Miami was not very far behind. I think we started in 1990. Sister Alpine gets the credit for that. And we've been doing it ever since in June. And of course, you're very familiar with ADASI and ICAMP, International Coalition for the Commemoration of Ancestors of the Middle Passage, based in Washington. And, they and you have been doing that great work of just networking and compiling, you know, all the places that have been doing these. And this month, August 23rd, is the International Day for the Remembrance of the Slave Trade and its Abolition, which was declared by UNESCO and the Slavery Project, which has been renamed as the it's now called the Roots of Enslaved People Project, with the theme of resistance, liberation, and heritage. And in Key West, Florida, where there's an African cemetery, 295 people out of 432 that did not survive or were buried there in 1860. And so we have an observance every year of that. So we're getting ready for that as we speak. And also there's a March 25th International Day of Remembrance of the Victims of Slavery and the Transatlantic Slave Trade. So we actually do both of those because Key West, being the southernmost point in the continental United States, is geographically closest to where all of that trafficking went on, and this has kind of multiple connections to it, you know, right down to having one of the very few cemeteries, African, where Africans who were captured and made the voyage, but were never actually enslaved. You know, they never made it to the auction block, which is, you know, in the scheme of things, maybe a blessing. But you know, there are only a few places around, you know, the globe where you have those kinds of the burial places share that characteristic. So that gets to be a very special place. And Key West has the kind of multi-layered, because there are, other stories, like the story of Sandy Cornish, who mutilated himself in a public place because he had his freedom papers had gotten burned up. He was captured by slave catchers after the Fugitive Slave Act and was about to be sent to New Orleans, and he just chopped off fingers, cut his Achilles, just mutilated his body to make himself worthless as a, you know, as a slave.
Yeah.
But
did
somehow
he live?
He lived. His wife sewed his fingers on with needle and thread. Every time I think of the story, Sandy Cornish. But he ends up in Key West, and he becomes one of the most prosperous, prominent citizens of Key West. He has a home, a farm, a fruit orchard. He supplies passing ships with fresh fruit. Key West stayed under Union control throughout the Civil War, so it was kind of the base for the second U.S. colored troops, and one of the first actual emancipation celebrations in the country happened there they didn't have to wait till the end of the war. Sandy Cornish was in the lead of that. So it's kind of a special place, and, you know, and I feel like, you know, how destiny brought me to Miami, it was kind of like destined that I would be close enough to Key West to be working with that community. Yeah. So, so that's you know, then, you know, we have, you know, other things, you know, the Seminole Maroon heritage that comes out of Florida is, you know, a whole other thing. And then, you know, we have a local coalition that's working with the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery. And, you know, you and I have both kind of discovered that lynching memorial, National Memorial of Peace and Justice around the same time.
I knew of Bryan Stevenson's work before that, but that's why I wanted to be there at the opening of that.
I mean, I knew of Astrotown before that. That's why I wanted to go, you know.
Exactly.
And so
it wasn't
arbitrary. I mean, I know this already.
Right, and well, that was both of us had exactly the same experience. So we were there for the opening,
mm-hmm.
and
yeah.
And for Astrotown, and
right. mm-hmm.
and so we have a coalition
before the ship was found, and now you
right.
know Africatown, you know, has films and more books.
I'm so glad to see you. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because
I remember
I remember passing through there in the 1980s, trying to find
mm-hmm.
where it was, you know, and
mm-hmm.
you know, guys as far as Pritchard and couldn't really, and you know, but you know, it's just so, you know, encouraging. And And part of my work has also been with the National National Association of Black Scuba Divers, and
mm-hmm,
you
yes.
know, I was glad
yeah,
to have a hand.
They found, yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
black
I was glad.
And they found that ship, you know, off of Key West, you know, the one that you were talking
right.
about.
If you're
doing
exactly.
the replica project, you know. Yeah, they're fabulous. They're absolutely fabulous. But
they are,
you know, I want to let people know that we, you and I have had conversations about, you know, honoring our ancestors for many, many years. So people could do a search and they could find great conversations with you on Wanda's Picks. I mean, I don't know how many conversations we've had, but we've had quite a few. So you know, lots of them, and they've always been so enlightening. And wow, it was so wonderful to have you on, and you know, and you actually met Baldwin, so it's nice, you know, to have you in the conversation, because you touched him, and so because we touched you, we touch him too, you know.
Yes, yes, yes. This is true. Yes.
And yeah, yeah. And then I don't know. Did you know Bernice Reagan Ashe Ibaye?
No, not personally. But I do mm-hmm. remember splash it made when Sweet Honey in the Rock, when that group kind of came to national fame, and they were just
mm-hmm.
I mean. You know, they just brought something very special, very timely, very necessary, very welcome. And
mm-hmm.
yeah, yeah, yeah. So, you
mm-hmm.
know, we bless her crossing over. And I know she'll be
mm-hmm.
welcomed warmly by the ancestors in her new life, you know.
Right, right, yeah. And our condolences to Toshi, her dear daughter. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
well, it's been
yeah.
wonderful, and I look forward to seeing you if we both go to the play at the same time, you know. I don't know, but
right. yeah,
it's
going to
be.
I'm juggling so many things, but the play just sounds so, you know, much like, you know, something to, you know, make time
oh,
for, but,
yeah.
you know, it's
oh, yeah,
yeah
no,
but
no.
it's.
Seriously, make time for it, because, but you can do it at any time you like. You don't have to do it live. You can just sign
right.
up and then see it whenever it's convenient for you. So you and dear Wallace, your wife, you know, can watch
yeah.
it together, and you can share
right.
it with your friends, and maybe if one of you all have a big TV, you all can watch it. You could have like a party.
You know, watch
it.
That could be good.
Yeah,
right, you know.
Yeah, because.
That might be cool. Yeah, yeah. So yeah,
mm-hmm.
we'll
mm-hmm.
see what can work out, because we have just so like our schedules are so insane. And then you know, this week I had to do cataract surgery and all that kind of stuff. So, but for something
okay.
like this, we'll you know, I think we'll find a way. We'll find a way. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely find a way, because he's 100. You know. He's 100.
That's right.
This year.
That's right.
100.
And you know,
like
now,
next
and,
year, 100. That's big.
Yeah, because you know, because I've done I've done artwork, you know, and we did when you know the 100th anniversary of Paul Robeson, we did something, you know, very meaningful.
Yes.
Likewise,
yes.
with Marcus Garvey. I have a
yeah,
sculpture called Duke's Flight, Duke Ellington,
and Thelonious Monk, and you just don't, you know, like these occasions call for
Lorraine
Hansberry,
you know, when it comes up. Mm-hmm.
No. That doesn't go. That does not go by unnoticed. And naturally, I'm going to be sharing, sharing this with like I say, my whole list of people.
And then I want to ask you, follow the show because, since I've been in graduate school, I don't broadcast every week necessarily at the same time. And so I have specials, like I have the Motherland series. I've got the Parable of the Sower series I just kicked off Wednesday. And then today, we have the centennial honoring of James Baldwin, Ashe Ibaye. So if you follow me, you don't miss any shows.
Okay. I don't like do social media that much, but at the same time, there's things
it's
I know
social,
I don't want to miss.
It's not social media. It's my program. It's not Facebook.
Right.
It's my radio show.
Okay. Excellent. Yes. Okay. So
I won't be not doing shows every day.
Right.
So it won't be that frequent.
What are you studying in grad school? If I may ask.
Oh, women's spirituality. Women's spirituality.
Oh.
Excellent. Doctorate. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Nice. You have your dissertation topic already?
I'm thinking about it. I'll share it with you, and you can give me some tips.
Okay.
All right. Not on the
phone. Right. Okay. I hear you. Okay. All right. Yeah. All best wishes for much success, and I know if you have anything to do with it, it will be successful.
It's like I'm in their house. You know what I mean. I'm in their house.
Yeah. Right.
So the ancestors are holding me up, but it is not easy. I gotta find me a support group.
Well, I think once you realize that you're in an insane asylum that's being run by the inmates, then you kind of okay. All right, so we can negotiate this. It's not going to always be rational what comes from them in response to what you're doing, but the fact that it's a resource that is usable for. Researching what you have to research and getting done what you have to get done, it has its place,
I don't know, child. I don't know. It's just ancestors want me here. I really don't know the answer to anything yet. It'll have to be one of those things you get through and you look back and say, oh, okay, I get it.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah, life throws a lot of those things our way.
Well, it's been so good catching up, publicly.
Yes. So by all means, keep up the good, and we'll stay in touch. I'm gonna see how we can do on this. Getting to see the play because that's really meaningful, right? Yeah.
Okay, excellent. Well, I sent you a link to the show, and within the description, there's a link for the Baldwin Centennial Project, and you can click that and get tickets.
Okay, excellent. Okay.
Mm-hmm. All right. You take care.
Again, thanks so much, and do the same. All right, and all the best to your daughter and the family, and everything good. All right.
All right. Take care. Blessings.
Right. Bye-bye. Mm-hmm.